You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
Lawyers who have looked at these filings have said, what has happened to the criminal justice system? Well, what has happened is that political assassinations in this country are given the same fate that the truth is with respect to the 9/11 events of this country, the Oklahoma City events of this country, the first bombing at the World Trade Center, all of that. These things are treated the same way, and they're just sloughed off.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, William F. Pepper. Today's show, political assassinations and the criminal justice system. William Pepper is an attorney and author and a poet. As the author of three books on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, he is also the chief attorney for Sirhan Sirhan and has worked for over a decade to get him a retrial. Pepper delivered a keynote address at the historic 9/11 Truth Conference in Chicago in 2006 and works closely with a distinguished team of lawyers now assembling a 9/11 legal strategy. He delivered the keynote address at the 13th Annual 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California on September 11th, 2017, Why 9/11 Truth Still Matters.
Thank you very much. And thank you for coming, all of you, none of whom I can see, but I certainly can hear you. This is the first time I've been to Oakland, and I certainly hope to return, and I certainly want to say at this very outset the admiration I have for the people who have struggled for the 9/11 truth to be known and finally to be aired to the people of this country and the world. I have a great deal of respect for Richard Gage, the Architects of Engineers, and a number of other organizations who have relentlessly tried to bring that truth forward. And all of your documentarians who have struggled so to put forward on the screen visual images that are undeniable in terms of the truth that has been concealed from the people of this republic for so long. I also have great empathy for and admiration for the families of victims who have persevered for 16 years to try to bring this to a close. I knew the Jersey Girls and still know the Jersey Girls well, and had great, great admiration for the way they handled Henry Kissinger when George Bush tried to put him in as chairman of that commission. So I hope that struggle will continue, and I know in terms of the families of the victims that it will. Now, in terms of my work, I'm told that it would be useful to discuss the cases of which I have served and been involved in for really pretty close to the last 50 years, but certainly for the last 40 years of my life. It might be useful for you to have a bit of a sort of a personal history so that you can put the context of how I got involved in these unlikely matters, really, and understand how it all sort of became a part of my individual soul and searching in this lifetime. As a boy, Llewellyn's How Green Was My Valley made an impact on me. The portrait of the preacher, the Welsh preacher, in the back of the church with his hand on the shoulder of the boy saying, you know, who had just criticized him about some work he was not doing. He said, you know, when I was a young man, I dream that I could lead an army greater than Alexander's, and I could bring truth and justice and happiness to the world. And as I grew older, I found out how much more difficult that was. And ultimately, I moved away from that to the daily tasks that I knew I could accomplish. And I empathized with the boy because as a boy, I had the same type of feelings about injustices that I saw around me. As a middle-class kid, couldn't find local boys to play baseball in the summer heat, so I had to take a brown bag of sandwiches into the ghetto and play with black kids day after day from my middle-class, working-class family, Irish immigrants. And there it was for the first time that I saw rats in a living room. Imagine that. Rats running across the living room, embarrassing Herbie Fields, my host, as we had lunch in between playing. So he threw his shoe at them. And I didn't know people lived like that. Bob Kennedy didn't know people lived like that. And that was why in 1964, when he came to me and asked me to handle in Westchester County his campaign as his citizens' chairman, I did so because of the alternative, but was not happy with him as a person. But the Bob Kennedy they killed had seen what he'd never saw as a child, and he had changed so greatly. And I'll come to that in a bit. He was going to do what had to be done to try to change the social composition of this great republic. As far as Martin King was concerned, I only knew him the last year of his life. I was a journalist in Vietnam and kept all my writings and recordings and photographs and film to myself until I returned. And I had to return. We had a crash landing in a place called Pleiku, and I had injured my back and my hip. And so I had to return. And I wrote a piece for a magazine that some of you may remember called Ramparts. Right? Some of you do. Yes, Warren Hinkle and even to this day, Bob Scheer carried that struggle, that journalistic struggle forward. In January of 1967, a piece appeared called The Children of Vietnam, and it documented by film and word the war crimes that America was committing in Vietnam. This was contrary to what Colin Powell was doing as a young lieutenant and press officer at My Lai, where his job and the way he earned his bones was to put forward as much of an explanation as he could to cover up that one tragedy, and I saw many similar to that. So I did this piece. And Martin King was on his way to Jamaica, and he was a subscriber to Ramparts, and he saw it. And he went through it and saw the photographs. And his bodyguard, Bernard Lee, brought back some food, and he pushed the food away, and he said, "I can never enjoy a meal again so long as this wretched war goes on." And then he asked to meet with me, and it was that meeting that led to my becoming close to him for the last year of his life. And it was his commitment then, and tears from his eyes when he saw additional photographic material of the massacres and the slaughters and the burned children, that caused him to oppose the war in Vietnam. And we brought 100 war-injured children from Vietnam under a committee of responsibility. And Martin never relented in his opposition to that war, even though he was told by everyone around him that it would cost him millions of dollars. And it did. and he was labeled a traitor. And he was attacked viciously by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And he stayed with that position to the end. Now, that was one of the reasons, in my view, that maybe a primary reason many think, that they killed him. But I think a greater reason was because he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington. They were going to, not going to leave. They were going to visit the elected officials, try to change budgetary priorities, and they were going to try to oppose the war and by doing that. And that may be looked upon as naive today, but back in those days, the military was worried. 100 cities had burned. The French almost had a revolution. They were on the verge of revolution, and if it hadn't been for André Malraux, they would have had their revolution, because Malraux convinced de Gaulle to co-opt the communists and the labor unions and leave the students out to hang. And that ended the French Revolution. But the military were afraid that Martin would lose control over that Washington group and there would be a revolution on the streets of Washington. So they had to make sure he never got to Washington, make sure that he didn't.
You're listening to attorney and author Dr. William Pepper. Today's show, Political Assassinations and the Criminal Justice System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So they took him out on April 4th, 1968, a year to the day after he delivered his anti-war speech at Riverside Church. And that finished that noble career and left the legacy of which we still strive to achieve today. But they finished him. That killed the possibility of that kind of revolutionary movement developing in the United States. Anyway, we worked closely together that last year. They killed him. I thought they had the right guy, as naive as I could be, I suppose. 9 years later, 1977, Ralph Abernathy, his friend, said, I want you to go to the prison with me, and I want you to interrogate James Earl Ray. And I thought he went round the bend, and I said, Ralph, what are you talking about? You think there may be something that has gone astray here in terms of justice? He said, I don't know. I would like you to do that. Took me months to prepare because I thought they had the right guy. Never did anything else. We went up and we saw James in 1978 in August. I interrogated him brutally for 5 hours. We came away with the strong impression that he was not the assassin. He was a diffident, shy guy who knew very little about guns, once shot himself in the foot with mishandling one, and he was definitely not the assassin. But we didn't know what role he might have played. So I kept going to the prison to visit with him. He kept asking me, finally, when his lawyer at the time, Mark Lane, dropped out, he kept asking me to represent him, and I refused. I said, I have to be sure you had no knowing involvement. That went on for 10 years. Imagine that, 1978, 1988. And all the time he would answer questions and I would go back into Memphis and I would start to gather more and more evidence and more belief that something was wrong. So it became a kind of slippery slope for me, that particular assassination. And so we went on and on. Finally, in 1988, I agreed to represent him. We took the case all the way through the federal system to the Supreme Court, and we were denied. And we had nowhere further, so we thought at that time to go. We were finished. Then a television trial was held primarily by Thames Television of England, and they roped HBO in on the funding of it. And we tried that case for 12 days, a jury came back and found Ray not guilty. It was aired in America on the day of anniversary of the assassination. I produced the first book that Bonnie mentioned on Orders to Kill, and Martin's nephew called me and said, okay, now it's time for the family. So the family and I met for over a period of about 9 hours in Atlanta, and I opened up all of the evidence that I had. And they said, what can we do? What can we do? Because I had written the book. We had lost in court. James Earl Ray died in prison in 1998. In 1999, I suggested we file a civil lawsuit against one of the people whom we knew was involved. Man's name was Lloyd Jowers. He was out in the bushes with the shooter and the spotter, and he brought the still-smoking rifle into the back of the kitchen of his grill and broke it down. And we had eyewitness evidence against him. He was afraid he was going to be indicted. Little did he know in these cases that the fix is in and he had no danger. But we sued him. We had a trial that went on for 30 days, 70 witnesses, all of the evidence that had never before been allowed to be seen or heard by a jury. And it took the jury 59 minutes. 59 minutes they came back and found the government agents of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis, were responsible for that crime. And there were no media present. They all left. Court TV was going to cover it. Somehow they didn't. They all left. There was no coverage of the trial, as there's been virtually no review of any of the books I've written on the case. Carl Bernstein said, don't be surprised about this. Back in 78, he did a Rolling Stone piece which indicated that the publishing might of the Central Intelligence Agency will make sure that these cases are not brought forward. They are not heard. So that is the reality. On the media side, it's not just mainstream media. It's progressive media as well. Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, people like Noam Chomsky will not deal with these political assassinations. Neither will they deal, of course, with 9/11 to the extent that they should deal with them. They just simply don't. And why is that? Well, funding comes from the Ford Foundation, which has been a CIA channel for a very long time, or Bill Moyer's entity. And there's a line that they don't cross, and they won't cross. I've come to believe these are not bad people, because a lot of the stuff they put out there is stuff the American people should know about, and it's good, and it's useful. And Chomsky's analyses are very helpful and enlightening in certain areas of the world. But when it comes to certain lines, certain areas, they will not go there. And you can't expect them to. I've learned painfully that they simply will not. So after that trial was not covered, I continued. We did a second book, Act of State, which went through the evidence of the trial. And that was in 2003. 2016, the final book was published. I had been at this then, on this slippery slope, coming to the end of the slippery slope that started in 1978. I had come to the end of it in June of 2016 when The Plot to Kill King was published. And what it revealed was staggering. It was staggering to me. I took so much evidence under oath and filmed the depositions and insisted that the text of the depositions, the critical evidence, be put in the book itself, in the appendices. So no one could say, as they would, he took this out of context or that statement was misinterpreted. The actual evidence is there. And what does it reveal? Well, it reveals something that the world does not know, and most of the world will not know because they don't even know that this book is available. But what it reveals is that J. Edgar Hoover used his number two, Clyde Tolson, to come into Memphis on a regular basis and liaise with the Dixie Mafia and organize the on-the-ground killing of Martin King. It shows that Tolson carried $25,000 in, And that money was carried to the prison where James Earl Ray was. James had been profiled and never knew this. And the money was given to the warden, Swenson, and James was allowed to escape. And then he became part of their network. He was under a handler whom he knew as Raul, who I later came to learn was named Raul Coelho, and lived, he was an ex-Portuguese intelligence operator who lived in Yonkers, New York. And he would leave his set-up job and do what he had to do. And we had eyewitness evidence of all of this, including carrying the money to the prison, because the son of the Dixie Mafia leader, Russell Adkins, rode to the prison with his father with the money. They gave it to the warden. So that aspect of the case was very clear. Then Martin was killed on April 4, 1968, but not by the gunshot wound that was fired from the bushes. He was hit by a bullet fired by the best shot on the Memphis police force named Frank Strasser, who still is alive, who had lunch with me, but he wouldn't eat. But nevertheless, on the basis of receiving $500, he came and sat down with me. And we made him a little uncomfortable, gave him some physical inflammation. But the only thing he would admit to was that his size shoes is 13 and a half, which was the actual size of the shoe that's in the Plaster of Paris cast going away from the shooting scene on the day of the shooting. But what he didn't know was that a 25-year friendship with another taxi driver who knew him for all that period of time caused him to reveal the truth. My informant jumped in the back of his cab after we had the lunch and said, "I understand Pepper's going to have you indicted on the King case because all the evidence now is clear." And Strasser looked visibly agitated and turned around and said, "What are they going to get me for something I did 30 years ago?" And then paused and said, "Or knew about 30 years ago." So we pretty much nailed him down as the shooter, along with other evidence of an informant who saw him practicing with the rifle all day long in the rifle range, the Memphis Police Department, before he left at 3 o'clock to go and take up his position. So the evidence became very, very clear about this whole thing. And then the final straw. Martin King was not killed by that bullet, but he was seriously wounded, gravely wounded, and might have died. But he was alive on the operating table in the emergency room when the head of neurosurgery, Dr. Breen Bland, came in with two men in suits and said to the working team, trying to keep him going, said, "Stop working on that nigger and let him die. And now get out of here." And he threw them all out of the room. And as they were leaving the room, the surgical nurse, I was the last one out, heard them gather up some spit in their mouths. At quarter attention, she turned around and she saw the three men spit on the body of Martin King. And then she saw Dr. Bland take a pillow and suffocate him, put it over his face and deny him life at that point. So Martin King was killed in the emergency room of St. Joseph's Hospital. Oh, he might have died from the bullet wound, but he was still alive at that point in time.
You're listening to attorney and author Dr. William Pepper. Today's show, Political Assassinations and the Criminal Justice System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
That's right, Bonnie. That's Dr. William Pepper in a very moving speech that he delivered at the 13th Annual 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on September 11th, not 10 days ago. Incredible speech, and I'm very happy to be able to bring it to you today, at least large parts of it. It was a very moving speech. This is a fund drive for KPFA, and I'm so happy that Skyhorse Publishing has provided Dr. William Pepper's latest and the most definitive, complete record of the assassination of Dr. King, his latest book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. This our a thank you gift today for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA for $120. This is an expensive book. It's a hardback, 728 pages long. It is the definitive record. It includes so much of Dr. Pepper's investigation, all of it really, into the assassination of Dr. King. It includes the original Ramparts article that he refers to in the beginning of this speech, The Children of Vietnam, with all of the photographs that he took in Vietnam that he refers to in this speech and which so moved Dr. King. The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. It's an incredible, incredible book. Our gift to you today for a tax-deductible donation of $120, 1-800-439-5732. Please give us a call. Support the work of Dr. Pepper and this incredible publishing company, Skyhorse Publishing. They publish a lot of books that don't get published anywhere else. And support KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online, of course, at kpfa.org. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In just a few minutes, after we get at least a handful of you on the phone by calling 1-800-439-5732, we'll get right back to this incredible speech. It went on for almost an hour. Of course, it was an incredible event altogether. Bill Pepper told me when I interviewed him that he considers himself a poet first, before an attorney, before an author, but a poet. And each chapter in this book, The Plot to Kill King, begins with poetry that Bill Pepper composed. The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. This is a hardback, 728 pages, 1-800-439-5732, $120 donation, and the station would be happy to send you this book, 1-800-439-5732. Let me just read you a little bit about the book, and then we'll get right back to Bill Pepper's speech. William Pepper was James Earl Ray's lawyer in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King, Jr., and even after Ray's conviction and death, Pepper continues to adamantly argue Ray's innocence. This myth-shattering exposé is a revised, updated, and heavily expanded volume of Pepper's original best-selling and critically acclaimed book, Orders to Kill, with 26 years of additional research included. The result reveals dramatic new details of the night of the murder, the trial, and why Ray was chosen to take the fall for an evil conspiracy, a government-sanctioned assassination of our nation's greatest leader. The plan, according to Pepper, was for a team of United States Army Special Forces snipers to kill King, but just as they were taking aim, a backup civilian assassin pulled the trigger. In The Plot to Kill King, Pepper shares the evidence and testimonies that prove that Ray was a fall guy chosen by those who viewed King as a dangerous revolutionary. His findings make the book one of the most important of our time. the uncensored story of the murder of an American hero that contains disturbing revelations about the obscure inner workings of our government and how it continues, even today, to obscure the truth. That's The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. This is a hardback, 728 pages. It really is the definitive analysis and revelations of the assassination of Martin King. $120 to KPFA, that's tax deductible, and the station would be happy to provide you with this thank you gift. Please give us a call and please support the work of Dr. Pepper, the work of the incredible Dr. Martin Luther King, by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. A $25 donation will make you a member of KPFA for a year. It will also entitle you to vote in the upcoming local station board elections. $25, $120, or whatever you can afford or see fit to support this station. If you're listening right now, then you listen to KPFA. Of course, I've mentioned many times before that if everyone who listened to KPFA donated $25 a year, we wouldn't even have to do fund drive. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. 1-800-439-5732. The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. 1-800-439-5732. When we come back after the next segment, I'll let you know some of the astonishing revelations that Dr. Pepper made in his speech that I'm not able to play for you today, and I also have some important announcements to make. So I'll give out the number one more time. Please support this station if you're listening. 1-800-439-5732. $120 for The Plot to Kill King. This is the definitive book on the assassination of America's greatest leader. 1-800-439-5732. Okay, Erica, well, let's hear the next section of Dr. Pepper's speech.
Now, the interesting nuance of all of this is that Breen Bland was the family doctor for the Adkins, the Dixie Mafia family. And some weeks before the actual shooting and killing, Bland was meeting with the son of Russell Adkins, whom the father had died. And the son was working with the head of police and fire, Frank Holloman, to finish the job. And sitting in on that meeting was young Russ Adkins, the same one who rode to the prison with his father. And he remembered, and all of this is under oath now, and he remembered Bland saying at that point, if the bullet doesn't kill him, make sure he goes to St. Joseph's so we can ensure that he will never leave there alive. So we had that separate type of corroboration to the sworn statement that connected Breen Bland directly with the suffocation. All of that is included in the appendices of the work on King. So far as I'm concerned and the King family is concerned, this matter is solved. Coretta died knowing all of these facts, all of the truth, even though the citizens of the Republic do not know it. And those of you in this room, most of you are probably hearing about it for the very first time. So that was the Kennedy warm-up, in a sense, because Bob Kennedy's lawyer, Larry Teeter, died, and I was asked to take on that case. And when I reviewed the evidence against Sirhan, it was so powerfully strong in terms of his innocence that I had to say yes to it. And so I became Sirhan's lawyer in 2007. I've been his lawyer ever since. What is forgotten about is that Sirhan did not have a fair trial at all because his lawyer was under indictment, federal indictment himself, and had to do exactly what he was told as he threw the case, as he denied the evidence. And I laid all of this out in court filings that I'm sure the judges who have denied our motions and our petitions have never read. I'm sure they've never read that. Lawyers who have looked at these filings have said, what has happened to the criminal justice system? Well, what has happened is that political assassinations in this country are given the same fate that the truth is with respect to the 9/11 events of this country, the Oklahoma City events of this country, the first bombing at the World Trade Center. All of that, these things are treated the same way, and they're just sloughed off. So we took on the Sirhan case and took it all the way through the court system. And as has been said in the introduction, we failed at the Supreme Court level. And we went then, and within the last month, I have filed a petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, one of the few international bodies that has jurisdiction, which the United States government must answer because of the Treaty of the Organization of American States. And we filed that petition. It's pending before the Inter-American Commission. Anybody who wants to help at all with that, please feel free to do so. Check out the IACHR, Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, online. Get their communications details. Write to them and say, we understand you are considering this gross miscarriage of justice. Please grant an evidentiary hearing. There has never been an evidentiary hearing for a panel of citizens to review the evidence of Sirhan's innocence. I had Dan Brown, a professor of psychology at Harvard, spend 70 hours with Sirhan, and he came away without any doubt at all. He's one of the experts on mind control in the world. Came away without any hesitation at all to say Sirhan had been mind controlled through chemicals and hypnosis in a clinic where they held him for 2 weeks, where he had disappeared for the purpose of being a patsy. And that's what he was. Upon a cue by a woman who was handling him, he got up. He saw the image that he had been shooting at the rifle range that afternoon, the target, and he didn't see Kennedy. Kennedy was 5-6 feet in front of him, and he pulled the trigger at that target. He fired two shots in front of Bob Kennedy. Then he was pinned to the table, his arm was held down, and the other 6 shots he kept pulling the trigger robot-like. Meanwhile, the assassin knelt down behind Bob Kennedy to allegedly tie his shoe and put the gun up against his back, fired 3 bullets, a fourth that went through the shoulder and left, but the third final bullet behind the right ear, about an inch away, was the fatal shot. And they could never match that bullet with the weapon that Sirhan had. That would be part of the evidence we're talking about. So Bob was hit with powder burn distance shots with a gun pressed up against his back, and everyone in sight, every witness said Sirhan was never closer than 5 or 6 feet in the front of this target. That's a basic piece of evidence, but it's only one piece of evidence. So we struggled to try to get the truth out with respect to that. We have no support from the media at all, who just will not critically look at any of these events. The only possibility is, of course, if if citizens such as are gathered here in the darkness tonight come into the light and make their voices heard so that we may have justice. Otherwise, this man will remain in prison for the rest of his life and die there. Now, those are the facts of those two cases. And they relate to the whole corporate mainstream media political tie-ups that affect and will continue to affect the truth about this great American tragedy of 9/11. You know, there was a time in this country back in 1967, I recall, that we weren't as foreclosed in terms of getting things into the media, whether it was progressive or even mainstream. I'll just tell you one little anecdote that illustrates it best for me. Bill Atwood was the editor, managing editor of Look magazine. He read the Ramparts piece that I wrote, asked to meet with me. I went in to see him. He strode up to me, shook my hand, and said, you'll be interested knowing I had a visitor last week. I said, oh, who would that be then? He said, that visitor was Averill Harriman, who flew in from Washington to see me at the request of the President of the United States. I said, what did Governor Harriman want? He said, well, he brought me the President's best wishes, and then he said the President had a favor to ask of me. And what would that favor be then? The favor is that I would never print anything that Bill Pepper wrote. And he said, what do you think of that? You're not even 30 years old, and the President of the United States is worried about my publishing something that you wrote? And I said, I'm more interested in what you said to him. And he said, well, I told him we're going to see you next week, and if we believe what you had to say, then we were going to publish and give the President my best regards. Now, there was the type of journalist we don't have anymore, really. The problem was, the next week, he met with Jim Garrison, who came up from New Orleans to discuss the Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy assassination. And Garrison, if I met with Bill for 6-7 hours, I don't know, Garrison must have met with him for more, 9 hours or so over dinner. He called Bob Kennedy, Bill Atwood did, called Bobby Kennedy at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said, Bob, the district attorney of New Orleans has just shaken me in my shoes and he's convinced me that the CIA killed your brother. And Bob's response was, we know that, but I've got to have the presidency in order to open the investigation and prove it. That was 1 a.m., 1:15, 1:20. Bill Atwood had a heart attack at 4 a.m. that same morning. Left Look magazine, except occasionally as a roving editor, he was finished. And he then published Look, of course, published neither my piece nor Garrison's piece. And Look has changed its posture and its policies. Mike Wallace interviewed me for lunch at an old restaurant called White's, used to be on 57th Street. And he started to upbraid me about how I was being traitorous to my country by reporting on war crimes that were being committed. And I was much younger, obviously, then, and I got very angry with him. And I almost hit him. And I was so furious with this guy who supposedly was running an investigative journalism. But these are the things that happen that people don't know about. And I work on the King case. I came to have a military intelligence access, which provided me with a lot of information. And I came to know about the role of a Colonel John Downey, CIA, as well as Colonel in the Army. And John Downey was the one who was chosen to coordinate the military on the ground if the backup was needed, they had two shooters. If the backup was needed for the civilian sniper, they were going to take Martin out. The military guys would. So Downey had that role. He died. I went to see his daughters, one of his daughters, and she said to me, and I think you might find this interesting, because these kinds of insights we don't normally know or hear about. He was the briefer of Lyndon Johnson throughout the war. He would come back every 2 weeks, once a month, brief the president. She said he used to harangue the president about the futility of and the immorality of this war in Vietnam, and why don't we get out? And he would do that every meeting he had with Lyndon Johnson. Johnson ignored him. Finally, one day, he was on his kick about the war, and Johnson had either had enough or had a bad day or something, but he pounded the table. And he said, "John, I can't get out of the war. My friends are making too much money." That's from the President of the United States, and it says so much about the importance of money leading public policy with respect to militarism in this country. And it's, if anything, has gotten so much worse later in time.
You're listening to attorney and author Dr. William Pepper. Today's show, Political Assassinations and the Criminal Justice System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
She said he came home that afternoon. He said to her mother, his wife, "Pack your bags. I'm having myself assigned to the embassy in Canada. I can't continue this kind of participation." And so he showed, as a patriot, he showed a degree of love for the Republic and disdain, contempt from the money forces that ruled and controlled this kind of policy that was costing us such blood and treasure. And off he went. But then a year later, he was brought back as head of the military 902nd Military Intelligence Group and given the job of coordinating the military backup for the assassination of King. And she said to me, he simply believed Martin King was a threat to the Republic, and that's something that his Pennsylvania roots run very deeply about, and he had to do it. So it's you are confronted with these kinds of gray situations where you can acknowledge the good work that some people do, and yet you have to also look at the evil that they can do. So these heroes we have to be looked at very carefully, whether they're ex-Vietnam War prisoners who are now viewed as heroes, where if you talk to fellow prisoners, you get a totally different picture of how they behaved at the time. So it's a complicated, very complicated world in which we live because of this. One conversation I had with Nelson Rockefeller, I came to know that family because at one point, and he instructed me and how I should behave if I ever would agree to enter politics. I told him I had no real interest in entering politics. This was around the time I had a reform activist group working for some years after having worked for Bob Kennedy. And he instructed me that a particular 8th Ward Republican councilman was a good guy so far as he was concerned, because even though I knew and he knew he was a crook, he was, as he said, Nelson said to me, he said, he was our crook, Bill. So there is a difference always that people are able to rationalize. I wanted to meet with David Rockefeller before he died.
Dr. William Pepper did want to meet with David Rockefeller before David Rockefeller died, because he wanted to talk to him about the assassination of President John Kennedy, and the evening before the murder at the Murchison home in Dallas, just to finish Dr. Pepper's sentence there. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We've got about 10 little minutes to raise some real contributions for KPFA radio, so I'm going to need your help to do this. We are very happy to be able to offer as a thank you gift for a $120 donation, tax deductible, of course, to this incredible book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. This is the definitive work. This is an expensive book. It's 728 pages. It's a hardback. This is the complete story from start to finish of that incredible assassination of America's greatest hero, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The Plot to Kill King, $120 donation. Please give us a call right now, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can always pledge securely online on the KPFA website at kpfa.org. The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. Pepper writes that the plan, according to Pepper, was for a team of United States Army Special Forces snipers to kill King. But just as they were taking aim, a backup civilian assassin pulled the trigger. And, of course, you've heard Dr. Pepper talk about him. He was with the Memphis Police Department. Of course, Dr. Pepper met him. He is still alive. In The Plot to Kill King, Pepper shares the evidence and testimonies that prove that Ray was a fall guy chosen by those who viewed King as a dangerous revolutionary. His findings make the book one of the most important of our time, the uncensored story of the murder of an American hero that contains disturbing revelations about the obscure inner workings of our government and how it continues, even today, to obscure the truth. The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr., 728 pages in hardback. Our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter, this is our premium for a $120 tax-deductible donation to KPFA. You can pledge at kpfa.org or call us right now, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA needs your support. Most of the people, I understand, who listen to KPFA regularly don't donate to the station. So we're always relying on those few of you who regularly do and sometimes do multiple times a year. 1-800-439-5732. But at the same time, I would like to encourage those of you who have never donated before, who aren't a member of KPFA, this is your chance to participate in our fund drive, to support the station, to support the shows, the books, the authors, that get a hearing that are broadcasted on KPFA where they're not broadcast anywhere else. You can't tune in to another radio station around here and hear this kind of material. Let's face it. KPFA is what gives the broadcast time to Guns and Butter. It's KPFA that provides you with information and analysis that you're not going to get anywhere else. So please support the station. It's very important. 1-800-439-5732. The Plot to Kill King, 728 pages in hardback for a $120 donation, 1-800-439-5732. This is the definitive, complete record of the assassination of Dr. King. As I mentioned a little while ago, the book also includes, among many, many things, the original Ramparts article, The Children of Vietnam, with the photographs that Pepper took in Vietnam that so moved Dr. King. 1-800-439-5732, $120. Please support this program, Guns and Butter, support your station, KPFA, and support Dr. King, Dr. King and Dr. Pepper, both of them. It's been 50 years for Dr. Pepper working on this. 1-800-439-5732, $120 donation. William Pepper went on in his speech to mention the fact that both Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were scheduled to be assassinated in Los Angeles, California, within 2 months of each other. But that apparently he finally realized that that was questionable strategically, so King's murder was moved to Memphis. Dr. Pepper talks about how he didn't understand why James Earl Ray and the assassination team had been camped out in Los Angeles and then moved to Memphis. But then when Bobby Kennedy was murdered, then he realized why that was. He also went on to say that Robert Kennedy, as president, and I didn't know this, wanted not only to end the war in Vietnam and end the oil depletion allowance, but wanted to end the Fed. I didn't know that. Well, Dr. Pepper has a lot of information. He knows a lot of stuff that we don't know, and a lot of it is in this incredible book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr., our gift to you today for a $120 tax-deductible contribution to KPFA Radio. Give us a call right now, 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732, or securely online, of course, at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to thank everybody who's called in today, who called in last week to support Guns and Butter and the programming on KPFA. Thank you so very, very much. I have a couple of announcements to make, but please keep calling 1-800-439-5732. The station sent me an article from the New York Times. This is sad news. Douglas Dowd, 97, anti-war activist and critic of capitalism, is dead. Douglas Dowd, a radical economics professor and author who was in the vanguard of early teach-ins and other demonstrations against the Vietnam War, died on September 8th at his home in Bologna, Italy. He was 97. The cause was congestive heart failure. His wife, Anna Hilby, said. And, of course, I and many of the listeners to Guns and Butter, we used to take Doug Dowd's free economic classes in San Francisco and sometimes in Petaluma. So I was very sorry to hear this. Douglas Dowd, 97, anti-war activist and critic of capitalism, is dead. Doug Dowd always said that there were three main characteristics of capitalism: that capitalism must expand, it must exploit labor, and must, and suddenly my mind drew a blank and I couldn't remember what the third thing was. So maybe somebody can email me and tell me. It might be that maybe capitalism had to exploit natural resources. That might have been it. Doug Dowd, dead at the age of 97. And there is the other, now keep calling 1-800-439-5732 to get your copy of The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. This is a 728-page hardback. It's the definitive work. 1-800-439-5732. Very quickly, I want to say that Christopher Boleyn, author of Solving 9/11, is on a speaking tour on his new book, The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East. He will speak at the San Francisco Public Library Richmond Branch. That's tomorrow night, Thursday, the 21st, from 6 to 8 p.m. He's also going to speak on Saturday, the 23rd, at the San Francisco State University in the Martin Luther King Jr. Library from 3 to 5. So he's speaking tomorrow night in San Francisco at the Richmond Branch at 6 p.m. Saturday, at San Francisco State University at 3 p.m. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Please give us a call. If you haven't donated, now's your chance.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Journalist, sociologist, and prophet Chris Hedges returns. He explains exactly how the economic elite managed to destroy American democracy and the social safety net. It's a fascinating story, and it begins about 100 years ago on the eve of World War I. I hope you'll stay tuned for the first half of an interesting conversation indeed. Chris Hedges has a new book, The Death of the Liberal Class. It's about the demise of the liberal institutions that used to work within the system, protecting people from ravages and oppressions by the system. These include the press, labor unions, universities, the arts, the liberal church, and the Democratic Party. By now, all of these have become ineffective, or were deliberately destroyed, like the unions, or have simply sold out, like the Democratic Party. Hedges spoke briefly on this subject, specifically on the Democratic Party, in our installment, Betrayed, at the end of November. This week and next, Hedges is speaking with Mike McCormick on Mike's excellent radio program, Mind Over Matters, out in Seattle. Here's a bit of a roadmap. After some preliminaries, Hedges takes us back to the 19-teens. Americans are overwhelmingly opposed to entering the Great War that is raging in Europe. We're going to enter it anyway to protect the bankers' profits. President Wilson, acting on behalf of J.P. Morgan, drags the citizens into this bloodbath through some oppressive new laws and, more importantly, an unprecedented massive propaganda campaign. After the war, the architects of the propaganda campaign went to work for big business, and the business of public relations was born. Business tycoons began employing the wartime propaganda techniques to remove every impediment to maximizing their own profit, such as liberal arts education, labor unions, and even core American values, such as thrift and concern for community. The process continues through today. Incidentally, as I sketch out these introductory notes, many in Congress are calling for using some of that oppressive World War I-era legislation that was designed to silence dissent against the war. They're clamoring to indict WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange under the Espionage Act of 1917. Assange's alleged crime, of course, was exposing the filth that is the daily business, so to speak, of the U.S. State Department. Here is Chris Hedges in conversation with Mike McCormick.
We are talking today with Chris Hedges, and he is here today to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing Death of the Liberal Class?
Well, it originally began as a book for Knopf on the press. And when I turned the manuscript in, Knopf hated it. I think Knopf and I were in agreement that the destruction of the mainstream press is catastrophic, but they were uncomfortable with my critique of it, its failings, which, frankly, I think I knew a lot better than Knopf did. And they offered to take the negativity out of the book for me and publish it. And you can imagine how that went over. So I sold it to another publisher. And when I was writing the book, I kept bumping into the fact that the press hardly existed in a vacuum, that it was one of the major pillars of liberalism, classical liberalism, and that its demise and collapse had been replicated by the other pillars of the liberal establishment, the church, the liberal church, universities, arts, labor, and, of course, the Democratic Party. And so I broadened the book to look at liberalism as a whole, what had happened to it, and the consequences of the withering away of these liberal institutions within our civic democracy.
So when did the liberal class begin this death spiral?
I think you have to go back to World War I, which I do in the book, and look very closely at the powerful progressive and populist movements that were reconfiguring American society on the eve of World War I. We had a strong socialist movement, radical labor unions. The wealthy power elite was in retreat. A few dozen socialist mayors across the country and many in fairly large cities. Publications like Appeal to Reason, the masses, had very wide circulation. And as the great political theorist Dwight MacDonald wrote, the war was the rock on which these movements broke. What happened in World War I had a profound impact on coloring of American society. The war was not popular. Wilson, in fact, had run for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But the bankers, Wall Street, once again, which had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, were terrified that if the Germans won the war, they would not get their loans repaid, not get their money back. And so they pushed us into the war. And Wilson had terrible recruiting problems, and there was tremendous opposition to the entrance in the war. And they created the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, which had a kind of diabolical brilliance. And figures like Walter Lippmann comes off in his book Public Opinion, which is a really foundational text for how to, as Lippmann calls it, manufacture consent. They built a system of propaganda that crossed all disciplinary lines. They had a news division. They had a film division that practically paid for itself, you know, producing Kaiser, the Butcher of Berlin kind of movies, graphic artists. They had speakers bureaus. But more importantly, they employed the understanding of mass psychology that had been explored by Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud and Edward Bernays, who is considered sort of the father of modern public relations, was in the Committee for Public Information. He was actually Freud's nephew twice over. And it was this understanding that people are not moved by fact or reason. They're moved by the skillful manipulation of emotions. People can confuse knowledge for how they are made to feel. And so when you read writers like Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, who held out against this war fervor, much of their despair is not only about how essentially the masses were seduced by the war propaganda, but the intellectual class itself. Wilson pushed through the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, but in fact he didn't have to use overt repression against most of the society. It was only that marginal fringe which refused to cooperate with the war effort, and of course this landed figures like Eugene Debs eventually in prison. After the war, two things happened. This massive propaganda machine, which interestingly was very closely studied by Goebbels and the Nazis. Bernays' book Propaganda was one of the instrumental books that Goebbels used to build the Nazi propaganda movement. You had the dreaded Hun instantly replaced with the dreaded Red. And you saw the more overt legislation like the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act used to crush the remnants of radical populist movements with the Palmer raids and publications like Appeal to Reason, although it had been forced to support the war and its editorial policy during the war was shut down along with the masses. And all of these figures moved to Madison Avenue like Bernays and began working for corporations, saturating American society, upending traditional American values of thrift and self-effacement to replace it with the values of mass consumption, to instill consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. We began a culture that, again, MacDonald refers to as the culture of permanent war, where there's always an enemy, external and internal, the whole sort of Cold War ideology, which became an effective mechanism to cow the population into passivity, and purge those elements within society that retained a kind of radical critique of structures and assumptions. So you had a decimation of populist movements, labor movements and independent press. Liberal institutions would carry out purges within themselves because of this sort of fear of being pink or being red. And the population itself, locked into kind of the psychology of fear, accepted an increasing intrusion of the state into their lives. As Randolph Bourne wrote, you know, war is the health of the state. And I think we've never recovered from that. The political and social theorists of the late 19th century, including Karl Marx, never grappled with the concept of mass propaganda and permanent war. It wasn't something that was on that radar screen. And that was really the start of our descent.
Was there any real resistance to this from any of the different sectors that you identified for that make up the liberal class?
If you read Malcolm Cowley's great book, An Exile's Return, which is an intellectual history of the period, he argues, I think correctly, that when you look at the Bohemians and later the Beats and even the New Left in the 1960s, the core values that they embraced were the values that had been inculcated into the American public by public relations firms and corporations, values of hedonism, the cult of the self, which was a radical departure. I think that what the public relations industry that was, of course, serving corporate interests was able to do quite effectively was destroy American culture or American cultures, because we once had many cultures, ethnic cultures, regional cultures, with their own sense of identity and self-expression, so that there was an homogenization of American culture and a reconfiguring of the values of that culture. And I think it's probably better described as corporate culture. That's what was bequeathed to us. Now, we saw, of course, in the 1930s, the breakdown of capitalism. And that was a dramatic illustration of why liberal institutions and the liberal class are vital to a state, because they provide channels or mechanisms within the power structure by which the grievances and suffering of large sectors of the population can be addressed. So we still had vibrant labor unions, although they'd suffered. We had progressive Democrats, people like Henry Wallace and Roosevelt himself, who pushed through the New Deal. And as Conrad Black in his biography of Roosevelt correctly points out, what Roosevelt did in essence was save capitalism. After World War II, strikes were illegal during the war, although there were many. But there was a series of strikes right after the war, a kind of rebirth of labor, and they passed in the name of anti-communism, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948, which was probably the most destructive piece of labor legislation until NAFTA. And then, of course, we began with Joe McCarthy. And it's interesting that George Creel, who ran the Creel Commission for Wilson, ended his career working for McCarthy and Nixon in the House Un-American Affairs Activity Committee. So you had then a ruthless purging of, and it's not fair to call them communists, but people who practiced a kind of moral autonomy, socialists, people who didn't buy into the narrow, rigid Cold War ideology. Thousands of professors and high school teachers and social workers lost their job. That's how America's greatest journalist of the 20th century, I.F. Stone, became a pariah. He couldn't even get a job at The Nation magazine, finally, and starts printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement with his wife. And so those last remnants were decimated, and the liberal class itself, even institutions like the ACLU, willingly bought into these witch hunts. And who is it that carried out the witch hunts? Well, they were the careerists. They were the people with the least sort of moral core who were willing to denounce, you know, many of their colleagues who didn't embrace this kind of orthodoxy. So as we saw the rise of the corporate state, deregulation, unfettered capitalism, we had lost the radical movements that could give us the kind of language of class warfare and the broad critique and the militancy to fight back. And we had also lost the liberal institutions who once played this very important role of balancing power between populist movements and the power elite itself. And we saw, with the rise of Bill Clinton, a very calculated effort to seek corporate money and do corporate bidding. Clinton knew that labor and the working class had nowhere else to go. And with the passage of NAFTA, the deregulation of the FCC, so-called welfare reform in 1996, the destruction of our banking system. Canada doesn't have a banking crisis because Larry Summers didn't rip down the firewalls, or Larry Summers-like figure didn't rip down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks. And so that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, the Democrats got more. But they sold out the working class. They sold out traditional liberal values. We have had a frightening consolidation of the press, of the commercial media, the corporate press. There's roughly six corporations that control just about everything most Americans see, watch, read, or hear. That's Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Viacom, General Electric, Disney, Universities have become corporatized. Withering of the humanities. Whole departments are forced often to find funding not only for their own research and grants, but their own salaries. So you have a slashing of philosophy departments, theater departments. University of Albany just abolished classics along with most foreign languages, German, Italian, French. And schools become increasingly vocational, especially state schools where you have budget cuts. You can get corporations to fund your business school, but they're not going to pay for students to read Camus. And, of course, accompanying that is the decline of labor unions. I live in the state of New Jersey, and our governor is very busy dismantling the teachers' unions. The last readout of union strength is in the public sector, and even that is being decimated.
On New World Notes, we are listening to Chris Hedges discuss how present-day U.S. got to be its dreary self. In the next section, Hedges discusses the program of destroying the institutions that tended to shift some power to the people. And he shows the bad results: the destruction of the ecosystem, the decay of once thriving cities, the impoverishment of a once prosperous people, and, since real reformers are suppressed, the rise of corporate-controlled demagogues to mislead a justifiably angry people. One point that's a bit subtle: Hedges mentions that you can't buy a tomato in Camden, New Jersey. The irony is that Camden is in southern New Jersey, and South Jersey is, or was, a major center for growing produce, especially tomatoes. When I was a boy outside of Philadelphia, fresh Jersey tomatoes were one of the delights of summer. Now, New Jersey supermarkets sell tasteless pink tomatoes shipped up from Mexico. And in Camden, you can't get even that, because there aren't any supermarkets there anymore. That's why the Campbell's Soup Factory was in Camden. The tomatoes. Back to Chris Hedges.
So do you believe the power elite and the corporations had this plan from the start? Or was it, you know, multiple corporations and wealthy people kind of each doing it piecemeal and just worked out well?
Well, there's always been a deep hostility to populist movements that inhibited the ability to make maximum profit. And the assault on the universities began at the turn of the century with figures like Mellon and Carnegie, who wanted to train young people to serve business and hated the fact that they were being educated in the liberal arts, which is, of course, if it's done right, is meant to challenge assumptions and structures and ask uncomfortable questions and critique the status quo. And, of course, at its core, it's about values. So it's not a new phenomena, but they altered and adjusted their tactics. You saw in the 1960s a very concerted effort to bring down Ralph Nader with a Powell memo, Lewis Powell, who eventually ended up on the Supreme Court, which I reprint in the book. And he brought in tremendous amounts of resources and corporate money, created the Business Roundtable, along with these conservative foundations, which ended with the collusion of the Democratic Party, Nader becoming a kind of pariah in American society. So I think that these inclinations are not new, but it's been a long process because they have had to slowly dismantle the barricades that prevented unfettered capitalism from reconfiguring American society into a kind of neo-feudalistic state, which is rapidly what we are becoming now. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class. NAFTA saw the kind of final destruction of our manufacturing base. There are whole pockets of the United States that resemble the developing world. I just did a story for The Nation magazine on Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not coincidentally the most dangerous. And there are no jobs, literally no jobs. And Camden was once an industrial hub. It once had a huge shipyard. RCA Victor was there. Campbell's Soup was there. All gone. 5,000 abandoned buildings, 100 open-air drug markets, 77% of the city budget is spent on police and fire. And these post-industrial pockets are spreading outwards. There's no supermarket in the center of Camden, because agribusinesses have created a system by which fruits and vegetables, if you live in the state of New Jersey, are shipped across country, and poor people can't buy tomatoes, so they don't sell it to them. We are creating a kind of permanent underclass And it's especially as state and federal programs are slashed. I mean, we are now facing the very real prospect that unemployment benefits will not be extended. And many people will have to attempt to survive on the $143 a month you receive from welfare, courtesy of the Democratic Party and Bill Clinton. The danger of closing that kind of safety valve that liberal institutions and the liberal class provided is that as discontent grows, it is expressed in very anti-democratic form, and we are seeing that already with the Tea Party and militia movements. Coupled with a rage against government is a rage against liberals. And I think that rage is not misplaced. I think the liberal establishment, which continues to speak in the language of traditional liberalism, has betrayed the very people that they purportedly defend, whose interests they defend. And I watched the breakup of Yugoslavia, the collapse of Yugoslavia, and I find very many similar parallels. You can go back and look at the collapse of Tsarist Russia. Dostoevsky is obsessed with this collapse of liberalism. It's what Notes from Underground is about. It's what Demons is about. It's the underground man, the defeated dreamer, that figure who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," then feels betrayed and says, well, only the buffoons and the idiots take over, and removes themselves from social engagement. And when that happens, Dostoevsky argues, your society descends into what he calls an age of moral nihilism. And I'm terrified. The same withering away of the liberal establishment is what permitted buffoonish and ridiculous figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman to be vomited up from the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. We're not immune from that at all. So although I'm very critical of the liberal establishment because it certainly in the end serves the interests of the power elite, one of the prime functions and the reasons the power elite tolerates liberal institutions is because they are the most effective attack dogs against radicals. I mean, I think the figure that self-identified liberals probably detest most is not Glenn Beck, but Noam Chomsky, because he calls them out on this. You can see it in when they do the retrospectives of the war in Iraq. You know, you had the liberal establishment, including my former editor at the New York Times, Bill Keller, identifying themselves as reluctant hawks. It pains me to do this, but it's the right thing to do. Well, that's the classic role of the liberal establishment. And now in the retrospectives of the war, they say, well, we weren't prepared for the insurgency, we weren't prepared for the occupation, but our motives were pure. We went in to bring democracy and stop genocide and create liberty. And that is the classical role of liberalism. You don't cross those parameters of questioning the intent of the power elite itself. And if you do that, then you are thrust outside of liberal institutions very quickly.
So there's a difference between the liberal class and the liberal establishment. Liberal establishment sounds like it's still surviving to a degree.
Well, but it doesn't function anymore. They've reduced themselves to the role of courtiers because they have no power. For the last 2 years of the Obama administration is a perfect example of the bankruptcy of American liberalism, because the Democrats came in and in essence codified the destruction of domestic and international law that was put in place by the Bush administration. Not only in terms of the furtherance of our imperial projects, the preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression, not only did they continue the looting of the U.S. Treasury on behalf of Wall Street speculators and swindlers who committed crimes through mortgage brokers and bankers, filling out fraudulent loan applications, giving money to people who they knew could never pay it back, and then selling these bundled derivatives as assets. The Obama administration has not confronted this severe dislocation that has been visited on millions of American citizens, 2.8 million people who lost their homes last year from bank repossessions and foreclosures, matched by another 3 million this year. The so-called health care reform bill is a sham. It's the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the for-profit health care industry, essentially $400 billion in subsidies for the pharmaceutical and insurance corporations, and now we're sitting around watching them grant exemptions because these corporations don't want to insure chronically ill children, on and on and on. And one of the things that the right wing is doing very well is tarring Obama, not only as a liberal, but they're calling him a socialist, because it is a way to discredit the values. And the sad fact is that the very destructive forces, corporate forces that created the mess because of an anemic liberal class will benefit from the misery that they created. I mean, you saw the New Yorker just ran this long piece on how the Koch brothers are, you know, pumping tremendous amounts of sums into the Tea Party and deflecting attention away from Wall Street towards government with very disturbing undertones of racism towards Obama and racism towards undocumented workers and Muslims. I mean, it's the classic finding, you know, channeling that rage or directing that rage towards weak scapegoats. And, you know, we live in a period of relative stability, but the worldwide currency crisis is serious. If you look at the recent front pages of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and what's happening to the euro and countries like Ireland and Italy and potentially Spain, we're not immune from that. I mean, we're playing a very desperate game trying to monetize our debt with $600 billion, which means, in essence, we're printing $600 billion of money. There's debate, and I'm not an economist, but there's debate across the spectrum as to whether or not it will work, but there is no debate over the fact that if it does not work, the consequences could be catastrophic. They want to create inflation, but can you create inflation and prevent hyperinflation? Can we sustain a level of consumption and an empire through the selling of debt forever? We sell $2 billion of debt a day to the Chinese with $12.8 trillion in deficits, the largest, I think, in human history. That's about 96 to service that will be about $96 billion a week we'll have to sell. And if China and the oil-rich nations don't buy it, then we're the Federal Reserve will buy it, which means we'll just print more money. It's not a sustainable solution over the long run. And if it all goes south, then, as I saw in Yugoslavia, where we endured hyperinflation on the eve of the war and massive unemployment and large-scale factory closures, if it all goes south, then that economic catastrophe will empower a very frightening right-wing populism, which we are already seeing gravitate towards the centers of power with the midterm elections. And it's not coincidental that the environmental crisis is twinned with the economic crisis, because corporations view everything, human beings and the natural world, as commodities that they exploit until exhaustion or collapse. I mean, even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, we would still rise to about 550 parts per million, 350 parts per million being that amount which has sustained the human species throughout our history. And we stand by as the industrialized nations and corporations go to Copenhagen and shred Kyoto as if climate change isn't real, as if it's not happening. So the consequences of an unchecked corporatism, both for us as a nation and finally for the planet itself, are deadly. I mean, quite literally. And the normal mechanisms by which civilians or citizens can be heard have shut down. We've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, and they've won, and we've lost.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to Mike McCormick and Mind Over Matters. Thanks to the University of Hartford and WWUH-FM. We'll have more of the conversation with Chris Hedges next week. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and catch you later.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear about the attack on independent media and the propaganda that you're fed on a daily basis. The only way the deep state can get away with and justify sending troops or proxy armies to Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, attacking, destroying, and occupying these countries is to keep you misinformed about what's really going on and to keep you fearing Islamic terrorists. An independent media is the only thing standing between the deep state and total control of the information you hear. It's common knowledge that the government and corporate media and some alternative media lied to us about Iraq in 2003 to justify our invasion of that country. If you listen to this program somewhat regularly, then you know how the government and corporate media and some alternative media outlets have been misleading you on what really happened on 9/11. And many, many of the other orchestrated false flag terrorist attacks. This is not the first time that governments have used orchestrated terrorist attacks to mold public opinion. I encourage you to look up Operation Gladio, where U.S.-controlled NATO and other governments were behind the terrorist attacks in Europe in the 70s and 80s, killing innocent people and blaming it on the communists. As more and more people become aware of what's really going on, the deep state players are getting worried that their program of serial, orchestrated, false flag terrorist attacks by Muslim terrorists such as ISIS, whom they control, to further their agenda of full spectrum dominance of the world is being exposed. More and more people don't believe the deep state corporate media and some alternative media outlets. The powers that be are losing control of the message. So first they came up with the term fake news to discredit alternative news outlets that expose their misinformation. I don't think it's working so well for them. So now they're trying to control the internet and alternative radio stations and what you can watch and hear. On today's show, you'll hear about this attack on the independent media and the internet. And you'll also hear some examples of truth versus propaganda. So let's begin with James Corbett on the GRTV Backgrounder, which is produced at globalresearch.ca, with Michelle Chusudovsky, also of the website globalresearch.ca, discussing the war on the independent media.
In the wake of London and Manchester, politicians around the world are trying to convince the public that the free flow of information on the internet is a terror threat. In reality, independent online media are exposing the real terrorists, the politicians and their deep state handlers who are funding, arming, aiding, and enabling false flag terror. Within hours of the bombing at Manchester Arena last month, police had identified the lone wolf suicide bomber they alleged was behind the attack. Mere hours after that, the independent online media had compiled a list of the many questions and problems with the official narrative of the event. That it was American intelligence, not British intel, who had allegedly identified Salman Abedi as the attacker. That the alleged bomber's father had co-founded the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group that worked with MI6 on a failed plot to assassinate Gaddafi in the 1990s and fought alongside NATO in his eventual ouster in 2011. And that Abedi's ties to ISIS were allegedly confirmed to the New York Times by two anonymous deep state sources. Within hours of the London attack last week, it was widely reported in the mainstream media as an ISIS-connected event. It was left to the independent media to report that the alleged ISIS connection to the plot was discovered by suspected Israeli operative Rita Katz of the long-discredited Site Intelligence Group, and that it is in fact the UK, the US, and their allies that have been instrumental in funding, arming, and training ISIS in the first place. When CNN tried to pass off a demonstration in London as a spontaneous event that their cameras happened upon, it was a citizen journalist who captured the behind-the-scenes footage showing that the protest was a carefully stage-managed event, including the reporter and crew telling people where and how to line up for maximum effect. When NBC tweeted Megyn Kelly's recent interview with Russian President Vladimir Putin under the headline, "Putin does not deny having compromising information on President Trump," It was online backlash that prompted them to issue a correction, admitting that Putin not only dismissed the idea, but called it nonsense. Time and again, the flowering of citizen journalism and online independent media has thwarted the establishment media in their attempts to convey a narrative favorable to the deep state. So it is no surprise, then, that in the wake of the latest false flag terror incidents in the UK, that British Prime Minister Theresa May has identified the free and open intranet as the greatest facilitator of terrorism.
Second, we cannot allow this ideology the safe space it needs to breed. Yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide. We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace to prevent the spread of extremist and terrorism planning. And we need to do everything we can at home to reduce the risks of extremism online.
The UK government has already implemented some of the most draconian restrictions on internet usage of any country in the Western world, including the Investigatory Powers Act, which requires internet service providers to store all internet users' data for at least 12 months in case the government wants to access it, and the Snoopers Charter, which grants government agencies and intelligence services the authority to hack into individuals' computer systems and the ability to collect masses of data on people's internet browsing history, regardless of whether they are even suspected of a crime. Now, the government is looking to prevent any form of encryption and enforce government-mandated backdoors into any form of online security. What is especially chilling about this is not merely that such a system is fundamentally unworkable, nor that network-level blocking has repeatedly been ruled illegal, nor that such legislation would decimate Britain's software industry. The truly chilling part is that the government is now openly advocating for the creation of a controlled, surveilled, restricted internet where all content is accessible only by permission of the government. The threat of this type of Orwellian control over information is evident for those, like Professor Michelle Chosadovsky of globalresearch.ca, who recognize that the ability to counteract the establishment propaganda narrative is the only thing that will effectively undermine the ongoing and ever-escalating wars of aggression that are justified on the backs of these false flag terror events.
The legitimacy of this military and economic agenda ultimately relies on propaganda. Without propaganda, they have no leg to stand on. Without the war on terrorism, which is a legend, it's a legend because the terrorists are a creation of U.S. intelligence. Without the war on terrorism, there is no legitimacy for bombing Syria and Iraq. Okay, we have to go after the bad guys, the bad dudes, ISIS, and so on. In fact, everybody knows that Al-Qaeda and ISIS, people who have studied it, know that those entities are supported covertly by the United States and its allies, finance, and so on and so forth, by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and so on. But that does not necessarily trickle down to the broader public. And then some people say, well, the broader public is ignorant. The broader public is not ignorant. It's the media which is, and the system which instills that ignorance. It's an engineered process of manipulation of public opinion. There are two things that we need to implement, and urgently. One is to inform the public, the broader public. But two, to question the legitimacy of this criminal undertaking. It's a collusive attempt to commit crimes against humanity on a mass scale.
Of course, the crackdown on the online independent media and citizen journalism is not limited to the UK. Governments around the world are enacting laws and empowering their own intelligence services to surveil and control their own populations, curtailing the ability of independent media to counter the mainstream propaganda.
The next voice you'll hear in this audio clip is that of Abby Martin.
Just this past weekend, it was revealed that in 2008, Australia's surveillance agency shared information about the country's citizens with its most trusted intelligence partners. Perhaps the most concerning part of this recently leaked Snowden document was the discussion between these allies over whether or not to share the medical, legal, and religious information of Australian citizens.
Breaking news overnight about just how much of our personal lives the government has been secretly surveilling. The Washington Post reporting a second massive intelligence operation, this one tapping into data of leading internet companies.
In one of the clearest and most disturbing signs that independent media is firmly in the crosshairs of the global elite, The war on information was one of the topics on the official agenda for this year's highly secretive Bilderberg Conference. This year's meeting of the Bilderberg Group brought together not only the usual gaggle of royalty, high-powered government officials, banking heads, and captains of industry from Europe and North America, but also a larger-than-average contingent of media executives and establishment-friendly journalists, including not only Bilderberg stalwarts like the editors of The Economist and Bloomberg LP, but Italian journalist Lily Gruber, Norwegian journalist Kjetil Alstadheim, and American journalist Amy Walter, as well as the editors of the London Evening Standard, Italy's La Stampa, and other mainstream publications. Ominously, joining this group behind closed doors were regular Bilderberg attendees Peter Thiel and Alex Karp of Palantir Technologies. Palantir is a shadowy data analytics firm founded in 2004 with the help of seed funding from InQtel, the venture capital arm of the CIA. Although the exact details of Palantir's relationship with the American intelligence services and their counterparts in the so-called Five Eyes countries of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the UK are not known, recently released documents have confirmed that the company's relationship with the UK's NSA equivalent, GCHQ, dates back to at least 2008, when they impressed intelligence officials with a demonstration of how their software could be used to track, trace, analyze, and de-anonymize internet traffic and online data on a mass scale. We now know that Palantir is a key part of the NSA's X-KeyScore program, which collects all manner of online data, not only emails, chats, and web browsing traffic, but also pictures, documents, voice calls, webcam photos, web searches, advertising analytics traffic, social media traffic, botnet traffic, logged keystrokes, computer network exploitation targeting, intercepted username and password pairs, file uploads to online services, Skype sessions, and more. Palantir helps intelligence agents map, trace, search, and organize this data in ways that make it impossible for people to pass information online without the government knowing about it. At Bilderberg, co-founders of Palantir were discussing the war on information behind closed doors with people like Sharon White, the chief executive of Ofcom, the communications regulator for the UK, and several of the reporters and editors who are charged with disseminating government-approved propaganda in the mainstream press. The implications of this are stunning, and they go far beyond a simple issue of public-private collusion around press censorship. At stake is not just the ability of the deep state to set the narrative of these terror events uncorrected by independent online reporters, but to define the very meaning of terrorism itself. If it turns out, as it did in the case of the Manchester bombing and the London attack, and the Westminster attack, and the Paris airport attack, and the Berlin Christmas attack, and literally dozens of other terrorist incidents, that the alleged attackers were all known wolves who had been identified by and often in contact with intelligence services before their alleged involvement in these plots, an independent online media might connect these dots to find a common underlying pattern, namely that these events are being aided by or at least passively allowed by these intelligence services, the same ones that have been caught time and time again, encouraging, funding, and even concocting terror plots in order to bust them just in time. However, if the deep state is in control of the apparatus for disseminating information online and censoring independent reporting, they can craft a very different story, one in which an overworked and underfunded intelligence system is straining under the burden of responding to all of these incidents, and only budget increases and even greater surveillance of the public can possibly reduce the threat from terror. If terrorist incidents are always tied back to shadowy groups linked to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, an online independent media might connect those dots to show how Al-Qaeda and ISIS were literally created, fostered, funded, trained, and equipped by the UK government, the US government, and their allies across the world as a tool in their quest of dominance of the Middle East and control of their domestic population. But such a story can only be told on a free and open internet, where independent voices continue to reach the masses and inform them of the truth about these terror groups. The truth, of course, is that the terrorists are the ones that are in charge of these organs of political, military, and financial power. The ones who are constantly terrorizing the public with these false flag events, and telling them that only greater governmental surveillance and censorship can protect them. To stop these terrorists is the prime political imperative of our time. And it can only happen through an independent media that is willing and able to counteract the official propaganda of events like the London attack and the Manchester bombing.
And next you'll hear Professor Michelle Chosudovsky.
When the lie becomes the truth and critical analysis is suppressed. Differences of opinion are suppressed. When facts are suppressed, then we are in an inquisitorial environment. It's not simply a police state. It's an environment where people don't think. They don't have an inner consciousness. And it is reminiscent of the witch hunts of the Spanish and French Inquisition, but it's much more sophisticated because it tells us anything that comes from high authority and which is then picked up by the New York Times and the Washington Post is the indelible truth. It goes into the news chains and every single local station will replicate it. And if anybody says, no, this doesn't sound right, they will automatically be put on a blacklist as a conspiracy theorist, a bit like the witches of the Middle Age in Spain. America's hegemonic project in the post 9/11 era is the globalization of war, whereby the US NATO military machine, coupled with covert intelligence operations, economic sanctions, and the thrust of regime change, is deployed in all major regions of the world. The threat of preemptive nuclear war is also used to blackmail countries into submission. This long war against humanity is carried out at the height of the most serious economic crisis in modern history. It is intimately related to a process of financial restructuring, which has resulted in the collapse of national economies and the impoverishment of large sectors of the world population. The ultimate objective is world conquest under the cloak of human rights and Western democracy.
And now we'll hear from the well-respected journalist John Pilger discussing the media. This edited clip is taken from the show The Sputnik with host Neil Clark. They're discussing the recent elections in the UK.
A lot has to do with the whole change in, particularly in young people's media habits, as it were. They're social media creatures now, most of them. Newspapers have made themselves, in many respects, defunct. They're not actually people. Newspapers as such, people actually quite like. They like the visceral idea of the newspaper. It's like books. It appeals right across the generations. But newspapers, playing this extraordinary propaganda card, have really destroyed their own power at election time in this country. It's quite wondrous to behold. Views dominate. That's the great reporter is not as celebrated as the great windbag. You take The Guardian, the whole stable of precocious windbags. Great reporting is quite different. Great reporting that draws conclusions, that seeks the truth through evidence and being the voice from the bottom, not from the top, being an agent of people, not an agent of power. That kind of idea of journalism, it exists in honorable exceptions in the so-called mainstream media, but that's really what we're missing, and that's why they got it so wrong. There were always gatekeepers, and the press was always conservative, and the press always represented vested interests. It pushed dissenting journalism, which is one definition of real journalism, because why have journalism at all if it is not going to dissent from the received wisdom, if it's not going to find out, if it's not going to push down facades and lift rocks and find out? That's journalism. It doesn't have to be aligned with any political party, but it does have to be a dissenter. So when you destroy that whole notion of journalism as a dissenter and make the media simply a foghorn for whatever establishment received wisdom is out there, that is not journalism as such. It's a form of propaganda. The creation of a second Cold War is a wonder to behold. It is such nonsense. Every bit about it is nonsense. In the United States, not as bad here, there's a kind of hysteria now. And this congressional committee that is hearing the likes of James Comey, the former head of America's political police, the FBI, as an objective witness. This is the FBI, which was run by J. Edgar Hoover all that time. He tried to smear everyone on it. There is no evidence, none whatsoever. Even the idea that Russia has interfered in the election. How did it change the election? What ballots were changed? How did it get into those boxes? What states didn't vote for the candidate that should have won because of Russian interference? The whole thing is nonsense. And yet you have newspapers, so-called newspapers of record, like the New York Times, saying, in effect, the Russians are coming. Comey himself said, which was reported widely across the U.S. in the last couple of days, they're coming to get America. I think I quote him exactly. I mean, in a so-called information age, which really is not so much an information age as a media age, to have this tsunami of propaganda about Russia and about the Russian president, the distortion of facts, the invasions that don't happen, are we living in a kind of a virtual fantasy world, in a sense, if you rely on the so-called mainstream media? But it's something I think most people now are really understanding. I think it's out. This election, in which the Mail devoted 13 pages of denigration of Jeremy Corbyn a few days before the election, were ignored. The Sun was ignored. And all the rest of the propaganda was ignored. I think people are onto it.
And next you'll hear from independent journalist Vanessa Bealey, who has been on the ground in Syria multiple times. This edited clip also comes from the program The Sputnik with host Neil Clark.
It was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary time because being on the ground there, both in August during the heat of some of the battles to the south of the city of Aleppo by the Syrian army to regain ground that had been taken by the various extremist and militant factions, and then basically being in East Aleppo during the liberation of the various districts of East Aleppo, watching events unfold on the ground, speaking to people as they emerged from what was effectively a five-year occupation by Nusra Front-led, so Al-Qaeda-led and dominated extremist factions funded, of course, by our governments and the Gulf states and equipped by Turkey, etc., etc. And then to be witnessing events on the ground, to be witnessing the celebrations of the people at their liberation, to be seeing the care that the Syrian Arab Army and its Russian allies were taking to provide the humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from districts prior to going in and basically cleansing them of the various terrorist factions. And then to hear this almost sort of parallel dimension going on outside of Syria by our media, by the UN, by NATO-aligned NGOs, and as you said, by the government in Britain. It was quite extraordinary. There was one particular story that broke while I was there, which was the story of the Syrian women in a particular district about to commit mass suicide because the Syrian Arab Army were going to rape them, or that the Syrian Arab Army were attacking their own civilians. One, I was there and I was on the ground and there was absolutely no evidence of this. There was sheer jubilation from the people of Syria to be liberated from this terrorist occupation. But also something that people just don't seem to understand is that the Syrian Arab Army is the Syrian people. It comes from the Syrian families.
Yeah, and Sunni, many of them, Shia, yeah, different sects, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And many of them were coming back to their homes in East Aleppo. So this was one of the most obscene, grotesque distortions of truth that I've ever actually sort of been able to witness firsthand. I mean, and plus, you know, we're talking here a Muslim society. To even suggest that women in this society would en masse commit suicide shows a clear lack of understanding of that society itself. So, I mean, yeah, it was extraordinary. It was sort of completely twilight zone, to be honest. I mean, when you have a nation and its army and its state defending itself against an illegal intervention of proxy terrorist armies and brigades committing atrocities against human beings inside Syria, against civilians, not against the regime or against the army, not against military targets, but actually almost universally against civilians, purely because collectively they've resisted this intervention. So it's collective punishment of the civilian population, which is ignored by the media. But when you have an army that is defending its country, that is recapturing its homeland from these terrorist proxies, it's described as Guernica or as Dresden, and the media, and this is where it's criminal, they leave no space for any political or diplomatic dialogue. They amplify it to such an extent that there is no recourse except military action, military intervention. It's criminal. But then you see the US coalition dropping good bombs on Mosul.
Humanitarian bombs.
Yeah, humanitarian, you know, totally targeted bombs on Mosul. And of course, then civilians suddenly are described as collateral damage, whereas the US coalition in Mosul have not provided any humanitarian corridors. They've not provided any humanitarian assistance. And equally in Raqqa, we're seeing the use of chemical weapons, white phosphorus. But it's very important to mention that the US has also admitted to using depleted uranium throughout Syria, as it has in every nation that has been a prey nation that it's attacked.
Yugoslavia, for example.
We've just had a report come out recently in the last couple of days, but they've used depleted uranium. They've admitted to using it. I have testimony from Syrian Arab Army soldiers on the ground of dreadful effects of depleted uranium bullets and grenades. And here we have the use of white phosphorus in Raqqa against a civilian population. Why? Because it's effectively aiding their proxy on the ground, the SDF, which consists, of course, of the Kurdish militants. And I have to make a very important point here that many Kurds in Syria support the Syrian state, support the Syrian army, and they don't want the Democratic Federation of Kurdistan. But these Kurdish militants that are being aided and abetted by the US coalition, and effectively what we're seeing is an ethnic cleansing of Raqqa. We have to be very clear of this. Over 50% of the population has been driven out over the last few months, but of course now in a more deliberate and intensified way by the US coalition bombing campaign, not only white phosphorus, but intense bombing campaign. And, you know, we're hearing reports of 300 being killed, but we know how the UN manipulates figures to serve various geopolitical purposes. So we can assume that those figures are conservative. Perhaps because Syria is such a unified secular state, and basically 80% of that population, if not more, during this period of intervention, support the Syrian state and the Syrian army. I mean, let's be very clear, there's still opposition members and there are still opposition on the ground in Syria that do not necessarily approve of the government, but they're supporting the government in its resistance against imperialism, neocolonialism, and an attempt to both carve up Syria, destabilize Syria, and plunder Syria, as they've done in Libya and Iraq.
So the war against independent media is on. The deep state continues to spread its propaganda through the controlled media, misinforming you about, well, just about everything, except for maybe the weather. But I'd step outside and see for yourself before I'd even believe that. Since 9/11, you haven't been told the truth by the government and its controlled media about, well, 9/11 itself, most of the terrorist attacks, the global war on terror, Russia, Syria, and all of the other illegal wars, and the origins and support for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the White Helmets, forced mass migration, and the list goes on. And speaking of forced migration, author J. Michael Springman has a new book out that challenges the official account of forced mass migration. It's called Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. Springman argues that forced migration is a subtle form of warfare waged by U.S. foreign policy with a double intent, to destabilize Middle East nations and to weaken Europe. And again, the book is called Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos by J. Michael Springman. And I'd like to also recommend the book by Professor Michelle Chusadovsky, who you heard earlier on this show, and it's called The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. And again, that's The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. And their website is globalresearch.ca. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges. We'll
And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The trade policies that replace NAFTA cannot be allowed to put the interests of multinational corporations first. As the renegotiation of NAFTA under a Trump administration teeming with corporate interest is positioned to do, we need an internationalist approach to trade that lifts up labor rights, environmental standards, and human rights for people in all of the nations involved in the agreement and provides good jobs for workers in the U.S. So the question is, how do we respond to Trump's nationalist hyperbole, which invariably allows corporations to pit U.S. workers against Mexico's or other countries' workers and working class interests in a global race to the bottom? Now, NAFTA renegotiation. Will working people continue to get shafted? We're joined by Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and Gisela Perez, lawyer and journalist who works at NGO Derechos Digitales and is a spokesperson for the coalition Mexico Against NAFTA, composed of more than 30 civil society organizations and trade unions. Lori, what really are the major talking points so that the global working class, if you will, does not get shafted?
NAFTA is effectively a deal that isn't much about trade, but that rather is largely about granting extraordinary rights and privileges to multinational corporations. Basically, the gist of what is necessary, perversely, to be able for Donald Trump to deliver on his promises to American workers, which was to stop the race to the bottom in wages and create jobs, is also what's necessary to make the deal work for working people in Mexico and Canada. And that is, namely, to get rid of the infamous investor state tribunals that allow multinational corporations to attack our laws in front of tribunals of three corporate attorneys who can order payment of unlimited taxpayer funds, including for the company's expected future profits, over any domestic labor, wage, environmental, health safeguard that they believe violates their corporate rights in NAFTA. Mexico and Canada have actually seen more of these attacks than even the U.S., and people in those countries have been hit hardest with those corporate attacks. Similarly, NAFTA banned the use of buy local procurement. So for communities in the U.S. and Mexico and Canada to be able to choose to reinvest their tax dollars into creating jobs locally, no, NAFTA forbids that. Multinational corporations need to be able to grab our tax dollars and run. And then NAFTA has no labor or environmental standards. It's a race to the bottom with no floor. And it's critical that NAFTA's trade provisions be conditioned on all three countries implementing strong and enforcing labor, wage, and environmental standards. People in the U.S. know NAFTA has cost almost a million jobs. And people know that brings down wages across the economy. However, Mexican real wages in manufacturing are 9% lower than they were before NAFTA. And they weren't a living wage before NAFTA.
The promises of Trump, which by innuendo, certainly only by innuendo, had to do with making better deals for the U.S. working class. What, pray tell, was he getting at? And is there any sense whatsoever in the middle of these oligarchs who have taken over government, these plutocrats, that there's anything affirmative that they are advocating for the working class?
So here is what is very peculiar. The Trump administration's corporate cabinet is packed top to bottom with a lot of people who supported NAFTA, TPP, except when it came to trade, Trump actually picked a change team. And in fact, the guy he listed, he named, who is now in office as his trade representative, a guy named Robert Lighthizer, is a guy who has had a very similar critique to progressives about NAFTA for decades. He believes in putting in labor and environmental standards. he believes in getting rid of the investor rights, the investor state system, the investor offshoring incentive. He believes that there should not be a ban on buy local, buy American, etc. And the real question is, the negotiations have started. Question is, are the other people in the administration going to call the shots, and we're going to see basically the NAFTA renegotiation become TPP 2.0? It's like the Secretary of Commerce, that guy Wilbur Ross, he's just been outright frank. He says, yep, we ought to modernize NAFTA. We should update it, and the starting place is the TPP. That's one worldview. And sadly, by the way, that was the worldview of the Obama administration and their trade representatives. There was a bipartisan, NAFTA was negotiated and signed by Bush 1, and Clinton passed it. There has been a bipartisan push for a very retrograde corporate model. And the question is, given most of the Trump administration has these corporate cabinet guys, are those who Trump appointed on trade, who really are for a different approach, are they going to be able to make the differences, or are we going to end up with more of the same? And I think the only way that we can have any influence on that outcome is people who really want to see NAFTA replaced, not tweet, not mod, replaced with something that works for working people. We are going to have to make sure our members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, have that same demand, that the corporate investor rights must go, that the ban on buy local must go, that the labor and environmental standards must be added. We have to make these such mandatory changes that a NAFTA that doesn't have those provisions can't get through Congress. And that is our best insurance as Americans to be able to shape for all of North America what the U.S. government is doing in the NAFTA renegotiations. So at the heart of NAFTA is not so much real trade rules, but those corporate rights I was describing, where literally thousands of multinational corporations get new powers to sue the U.S. government in front of tribunals of three corporate attorneys, can order the government to pay unlimited sums of taxpayer money under claims that any domestic law, court ruling, regulation, environmental, health, safety, you name it, undermines the new rights and powers that NAFTA gives to corporations. Those rules mean our most essential environmental consumer health laws on which our families rely are at risk, but also it means U.S. corporations have those same rights to attack Canada and Mexico and their policies. And when they have those rights, when it comes to Mexico, it's like government-paid insurance to leave. It's an incentive to offshore. It's an expense you don't have to worry about going to a low-wage country where if the government tries to raise wages, you can drag them in front of three corporate lawyers and raid the Mexican treasury. If they try and make you not pollute, you can drag the Mexican government in front of a tribunal of three corporate lawyers and make the Mexican tax. And you don't have to ever pay for getting rid of any risk. Normally, if you're going to a low-wage country, you'd buy risk insurance. Instead, you have these extraordinary rights that even go beyond what your insurance would guarantee. It's an incentive to offshore. Lowers the risk premium of offshoring. It creates incentives to offshore when it doesn't even make economic sense. Alternatively, if those rules are out, then we can look to see if some of these other provisions that need to be added or taken out are part of the deal. Hundreds of environmental, consumer, family farm, faith, civil rights, human rights groups all saying no ISDS. It's a common demand, as well as scores of Democratic members of Congress saying the same thing. And the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Association of all the state legislatures, the National Association of Attorney Generals, everyone who cares about the rule of law, who cares about environmental and health safeguards, who cares about fair wages, anyone who's worried about corporate power, which that would basically be everyone across the political spectrum except for the large corporations, we all need to see ISDS taken out. And so when we all look at what the Trump administration does with NAFTA, one super clear indicator for all of us will be, have they done something about these investor privileges and the investor state tribunals? And if they have, as perverse as it may seem, it being the Trump administration, they may be on to actually making some changes that would be useful for people in all three countries. If they haven't done this, that's the red line. Then there's just no hope.
And we are also joined by Gisela Perez, who I said is a lawyer and journalist who works at NGO Derechos Digitales in Mexico. And we'd like to welcome you to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. As I was saying, I completely agree with what Lori has been saying. Trump's narrative is that where American workers have lost, the Mexican economy has gained, but that's not necessarily true either. You know, Mexico's economy has only grown for an average of 2.5% a year since 1994 NAFTA. That's only a fraction of what was needed to provide the jobs that were promised at the time. More than half of Mexicans still live below the poverty line, and this hasn't changed since 1993. There's this whole discourse on how new technologies have actually increased productivity, which is essentially good for businesses, but we have to think that this is also a blow to the workforce. And, well, essentially, just to sum things up, here in Mexico, more than two-thirds, according to recent polls of March, around March or May last year, two-thirds of the Mexican population believe that NAFTA has benefited American consumers and producers, but only 20% consider it has benefited Mexicans in general. So this narrative that Trump has been working on since the election, for the past elections in the United States, is also not true. I dare to question it. And from the coalition that we have built, leftist coalition against NAFTA here in Mexico, we also believe that Trump's racist agenda against Mexicans cannot be free and fair trade. This new treaty is being negotiated behind closed doors. It's only corporations and states that have representation, as Lori has been very well explaining. And why would we believe somebody that has constantly repeated that Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers and that we have to build a wall where racial subjugation has been a tool for keeping those already in power to make them more powerful? So there is a connection between both debates from my perspective, which we have to take into consideration to consider a new concept of trade justice, which is the respect for human rights as well.
Laura, you want to respond to that?
I think that the Trump administration has itself painted into a corner exactly the way we just heard. Trump has used the most vile, racist, xenophobic language aimed at Mexico and Mexicans. Perversely, what he has said about trade and jobs, he can only deliver on if he makes changes that actually help the Mexican people, as well as working people here. He is now in a situation where he has failed to deliver on most of the things that he promised. Those working class voters who sort of used him as their human Molotov cocktail, not the deplorable racist, not the people who voted for him because of what he said about Mexico and Mexicans, but the people who have had it with the elite political class of both parties, who couldn't stomach Hillary Clinton's status as too close to Wall Street and too close to the original NAFTA, and people who I have talked to, many people who are in labor unions, who said they found Trump repulsive, but they hoped he would shake things up. They had sort of hit the basta moment. They had just had it. For those people, Trump loses them, and the numbers are showing he's starting to, unless he can deliver on some of the things he promised that would make their direct lives better. Well, they ain't coming in health care. That's not happening. And for some people, they're relieved Obamacare didn't get tanked, but he blew so much smoke that people were expecting some miracle. He's not going to make Medicare and Medicaid better, as he promised. So what's left? It's the manufacturing jobs and it's trade. And it's the issue that he brings up every damn time he gets in trouble politically. Well, for him to do what he said he was going to do, bring up wages, create jobs, and bring down the trade deficit, a key component of that is raising wages, labor standards, and environmental standards in Mexico. It is getting rid of the industrial rights.
Yes, totally. There's a very interesting proposal of Bernie Sanders and the leftist senator here that they say raise wages, not walls. And precisely one of the things that Canada has been complaining the most is that they cannot compete against the super low wages that exist here in Mexico. Actually, in the OECD standards, we were the worst rated country in terms of minimum wages in 2016. We pay $14 a day versus $50 a day, which is the average. But one of the problems that labor and trade unions have put forward here in Mexico is also that a minimum protection for labor wages should not be only centered in protecting the rights of the capital, but also protecting workers themselves in terms of their human rights, especially when we connect it to migration or even agricultural issues. We have to take into consideration there's the industry. A lot of arguments have been made pro-creating jobs, not to have created jobs at the industry level, but actually at the agricultural level, with local farmers, more than 2 million jobs have been lost in the agricultural field. Taking those two into consideration, one of the claims here in Mexico has been to protect the rural workers, protect the farmers that grow their own food, especially also because of corn, right? We lost our food sovereignty because we are importing. Mexico is one of the top buyers of American corn. We have come to import one of the most important and ancestral production, food production materials. There is even a book, the Popol Vuh, that was dedicated to corn as a sort of deity. So all these three components, migration, agricultural, and labor rights, have to come together to protect not only the enterprises that cannot compete against Mexican low wages, but actually the people themselves that are losing their jobs to big multinationals.
Laura, there was side agreements with regard to labor and the environment that were really never enforced. Is there any possibility that this will come up in the negotiations? And is there any possibility to get strong labor and environmental agreements?
Well, absolutely. They're not going to be side agreements. The U.S. proposal is to have in the core text of the agreement a requirement that countries adopt into their domestic law and enforce international labor standards. And the environmental proposal is much less clear with what the standards will be, with violations being deemed a violation of the agreement. The problem is that is similar to the language that was in the TPP. And we've had a long track record of those, for instance, with the Peru Free Trade Agreement, the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. That mechanism alone does not cut it, because effectively the trade agreement goes into effect. The elite in a country lose all interest in raising standards, improving the safeguards, the human rights, the protections for workers. And then when there are violations, there's a long and drawn-out process where you have a tribunal of trade experts deciding if there's been a violation. And the only case that's ever come to a ruling, which was in the case of Guatemala under CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, where there's no question there are heinous labor violations in Guatemala. And in that case, the standards were such that the tribunal never found there was a violation. There's no sanction. And workers have died. Unions are being assassinated. This was not a close call case. This is not like a worker safety case. This is a mob of thugs go break up strikes and drag away the leaders and kill them. But I wanted to go back to the food issue, because I think for a lot of progressive people who might be listening to your show, they think, we're the people who are international. It's Trump and his isolationism that blows up things like the Paris Agreement, the climate agreement. And it's super important for folks to actually know what is in NAFTA. Like the idea of North America coming together under the right rules could be a pull-up agreement that would raise standards and increase protections through the hemisphere. But NAFTA's specific terms set in 1992 in negotiations behind closed doors with corporate advisors specifically are not about free trade and are about putting the thumb on the scale in the favor of the big and the corporate. And the food issue, there is no clearer case. 2 million people, peasant farmers, lost their livelihoods. How can that be? Because at the same time, the U.S. now has a trade deficit of $6.8 billion with Mexico and Canada in agriculture. We had a trade surplus, $2.4 billion before NAFTA. Huge flood of corn comes. It's subsidized. There is no way farmers in Mexico can actually compete against those exports. The increase is
literally multiples of 70 times over of exports of corn. But how do we have a deficit? Because the rules allow consolidation in the service sector such that a bunch of the milling and grain trading companies, the meat packing companies, all had new rights to buy up capacity in Mexico. So not only did 2 million peasant farmers lose their livelihoods, but a lot of small business owners, what was the middle class NAFTA supporters, who had food processing plants and small retail chains who've now come out against NAFTA because it wiped them out, because you have the big agribusiness companies, the meat packers, the grain millers, they moved production to Mexico to try and abuse, to take advantage of these abusive wages and to take advantage of the lack of worker safety in the very dangerous meatpacking industry. And then what they would do is play farmers in Mexico and in the U.S. and Canada off each other. Oh, it's time to sell your cattle. Well, we can get this price in Mexico. What are you going to get in Canada? Oh, Mexican farmers, we can get this price in the U.S. What will you pay us? Racing the farmers down to the bottom, getting the cattle, bringing them over the border, putting them into feedlots there and slaughtering them. The United States now has a trade deficit in beef with Mexico. How is that possible? The U.S. multinational meat packers and feedlots have lock, stock, and barrel moved over the border, polluting water and communities in Mexico, and net manufacturing work, and meat packing is concerned manufacturing, the actual number of jobs in Mexico now is lower than before NAFTA. Not only are the wages lower, so all that's bad, wages lower, but guess what? The price of tortilla, Mexico's staple crop, has actually gone up. Companies in Mexico, U.S., and Canada, in this case, Bimbo, the huge tortilla-making wheat milling company in Mexico, bought up a bunch of capacity, including Wonder Bread, the iconic U.S. terrible white bread. And Bimbo is now the major buyer of wheat and corn, not just from Mexican farmers, but now U.S. farmers, and is playing the same damn race to the bottom game. But then they can price the food whatever way they want. So the price of tortilla in Mexico City since NAFTA have increased 3 times. Wages are down 9%.
And Gisela Perez, Mexican civil society has a platform on the start of the renegotiation of NAFTA. Can you talk about that as well?
And the big demonstration in Mexico City.
Coming back quickly on what Lori was saying, effectively, tortilla is one of our main meals here in Mexico. Corn is one of the main meals. As I was saying, it was considered a deity by ancient ancestral cultures. Also, like this brings the point of transgenic seeds and transgenic crops. If we take the chapter of the TPP, via intellectual property, NAFTA would actually protect Monsanto or these big multinationals versus the farmers' rights to seeds. It would prevent farmers, if we protect by intellectual property rights transgenic crops, two things would happen. One, it would prevent farmers to exchange their seeds, their own seeds, taking them by from Monsanto. And two, it would also feed a very large variety of corn. We have a lot of variety of different corn, but it's actually better. It's more resistant to climate change, and it's healthier than the transgenic and genetically modified organisms that we are importing right now, which are also more expensive. So in terms of food sovereignty, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And regarding the demonstration, over between 4,000 and 5,000 farmers, trade unions, workers, and students came together to protest against NAFTA. One of the most vocal, we actually made a document, we read it outside of the U.S. Embassy, and then we went to the foreign minister to actually hand it in. One of the most vocal claims was exactly against the privileging of the big multinational companies instead of rural workers and farmers. There's this question on whether if we should just withdraw from NAFTA and what would the implications be, or whether if we should just replace it. And I think this doesn't have a lot to do with class issues here in Mexico. Of course, the highest classes tend to say, oh, this agreement has been good for us and people and let's benefit free trade. But in that demonstration, what I saw was a lot of rage, a lot of anger, a lot of claims for justice. NAFTA is seen as an unjust as an unjust fair trade deal. We are forming a leftist coalition of civil society, but also trade unions and students that are coming together to protest this trade agreement that since 1994 has affected the most marginalized regions and the most marginalized people in our country. Yeah, and regarding, there's also a big topic regarding intellectual property that we should take into consideration. It's not only the protection of transgenic crops, but also this could impede, for example, the creation of generic medicines in biopharmaceuticals if tomorrow they discover a cure for HIV, cancer, or Ebola. And in Mexico, we must say more than 80% of people consume and buy generic medicines because we cannot afford private patented medicines. And the intellectual property chapter of NAFTA could actually be a matter of life and death for a lot of people that do not have the economical resources to buy medicines from the patented pharmaceuticals.
And we will continue this discussion in the weeks and months that come by getting our good friend Jacela Perez online, and we will do more next time and take a closer look at what is happening in Mexican civil society. And Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, always go to the website. It is really replete with extremely important information, and we've got a lot of work to do as the negotiations continue. A final 30-second comment, Lori and Jacela?
Lori here, I just want to say the only good thing that I think has come out of NAFTA is the partnerships across civil society with organizations like Derechos Digitales and other of our counterparts in Mexico and Canada, because it really makes so clear that there are people in each of the three countries available to educate, empower, inform, and organize our fellow citizens, residents, friends and family to make sure that either we have a NAFTA that replaces the current damaging one with real rights, or we have no NAFTA. And the hope, the pleasure of the NAFTA is simply the power of the people of North America united to make sure we either get better or we at least stop the damage. And so with that, I will thank you all very much, both the host and Derechos Digitales. You do great work. And I look forward to working with you going forward. And I'm going to lose you guys. I'm going to say bye.
Bye-bye, Lori Wallach. And we, the workers of the world, have nothing to lose but our chains when we unite and fight. Again, Jacela Perez, will be back to you in the weeks and months that come. So much to be said about what's going on in Mexican civil society and the work that your very important NGO does, Derechos Digitales. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We had to try to make this work because we know that with the postal survey that it will get very nasty.
The vibe of the callers is that people are distressed and they're distraught.
This is a serious discussion about real people's lives.
Campaigners point to the Brexit vote and the election of US President Donald Trump as evidence nothing can be taken for granted.
I'll vote yes in your plebiscite, though it's one more blow unto our plight.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Trump's Justice Department ices Supreme Court queer rights cake. Trans ban and DACA denial further rile U.S. activists. And Australia's mail-in marriage vote gets High Court stamp of approval. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 9th, 2017. Australia's High Court has cleared the way for the government's voluntary, non-binding marriage equality postal plebiscite. The single ballot question will ask, should the law be changed to allow same-sex couples to marry? A majority yes vote will presumably trigger a bill in Parliament to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Opponents argued that the government didn't have parliamentary approval to spend the estimated $122 million in taxpayer funds on the mail-in vote, and that it was inappropriate to assign the task to the country's Statistics Bureau instead of the Electoral Commission. But the justices agreed with the coalition government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that it had the right to spend funds that had already been budgeted for urgent and unforeseen matters. Ballots will start being mailed out this week. The results are expected to be announced on November 15th. As Andrew Probyn concluded in a September 8th Australian Broadcasting Company analysis of the situation, the Prime Minister now needs the postal survey to deliver a majority yes result so the matter can be brought to a vote in the House of Representatives. And that's the irony here. This issue has always been one that will have to be resolved by a free vote of all MPs. The plebiscite pantomime has primarily been about how you get to that free vote. We'll have the latest sound and fury down under from our correspondent Barry McKay in Sydney later on most of these This Way Out stations.
Remember candidate Donald Trump's promise to protect LGBT people? His Department of Justice filed a friend of the court brief this week in a case to be heard in October by the U.S. Supreme Court. It involves a Christian conservative Colorado baker's refusal to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. And the Trump administration is siding with the baker's right to discriminate based on his religious beliefs. Lawyers from the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom are representing Masterpiece Cake Shop owner Jack Phillips. They're arguing that Phillips has a First Amendment right to deny his artistic talents to a creation that violates his faith. At least 86 Republican lawmakers from both houses of Congress have also signed on to a friend of the court brief supporting the cake maker, arguing that it's a matter of not only his religious freedom, but of his free speech rights. Colorado courts and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission have all ruled against Phillips. It's unlawful for businesses serving the public in the state to discriminate based on sexual orientation. The couple, David Mullins and Charlie Craig, are represented by the ACLU. The advocacy group's James Essex said that, while the right to one's religious beliefs is fundamental, a license to discriminate is not. A U.S. High Court ruling for the Christian cake maker could encourage repeal of dozens of current state and local laws that currently protect LGBT people from discrimination.
Lawyers for the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal petitioned the Supreme Court this week to hear the workplace discrimination lawsuit of a Georgia lesbian. They're arguing that Georgia Regional Hospital harassed and subsequently forced Jamaica Evans out of her job as a security officer because of her sexuality and gender nonconformity. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 bans sex discrimination in the workplace, And her lawyers argue that sex discrimination includes discrimination based on sexual orientation. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has supported Title VII protections for LGBT people in federal courts since 2015. But the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling in March that decided that Evans' sexual orientation was not a factor in the case. In April, the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals cited Title VII in ruling for a college instructor who was fired for being lesbian. Whether or not Title VII protects LGBT people has been at the heart of several other federal workplace bias lawsuits. The Supreme Court will almost certainly have to eventually resolve the question. Since the High Court has already decided to hear that Colorado cake baker's case, it's not clear if the justices will agree to hear a second queer-related case in their upcoming session.
Meanwhile, the statewide advocacy group Equality California has filed what is now a fourth lawsuit, this one on behalf of several transgender enlistees from the Golden State, challenging President Trump's edict banning their military service. The plaintiffs in the new lawsuit include Army Sergeant Jacquees Tate, an Iraq War veteran and military police officer who served since 2008, and Aiden Stockman, who's identified as a transgender male since the eighth grade. The lawsuit notes that Stockman had delayed enlisting in the Air Force last year after the Obama administration opened service to trans people because he wanted to first complete a double mastectomy. Similar complaints contesting the trans ban have been filed by the ACLU in Maryland, Lambda Legal in the state of Washington, and jointly by the National Center for Lesbian Rights and GLBTQ legal advocates and defenders in Washington, D.C. They all essentially argue that Trump's reversal of the Obama-era policy embracing transgender service members lacks a rational basis. They also dispute Trump's claims of confusion among the troops over trans inclusion and excessive health care costs. Several studies note that the Pentagon spends up to 10 times more for Viagra than for the trans-related health care of its service members.
Several LGBTQ advocacy groups have strongly condemned President Trump's move to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, that has protected close to 800,000 young immigrants, mostly from Mexico and Central America, from deportation. In announcing the move this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions gave Congress 6 months to pass legislation to save the program. President Obama created DACA through executive action 5 years ago. It allows undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children and who meet rigorous qualification criteria to get permits to go to school and work in the country legally without fear of deportation. Mara Keisling of the National Center for Transgender Equality called Trump's decision an assault on human rights and human decency. Kate Kendall of the National Center for Lesbian Rights described Trump's move as brutally vicious and depraved, pointing out that it places DACA recipients who identify as LGBT in an even more precarious position, putting their dreams, their futures, and potentially their safety at risk. And Alejandro Aviles of the Human Rights Campaign said the DACA reversal is yet another hateful decision by the Trump-Pence administration.
And finally, the world is saying goodbye to trailblazing feminist writer Kate Millett, who passed away this week at the age of 82. London's Guardian newspaper reported that she succumbed to a heart attack during an annual holiday in Paris to celebrate her birthday with her wife and longtime collaborator, photojournalist Sophie Kier. Millett's doctoral thesis that became the book, Sexual Politics, questioned the origins of patriarchy, which she said were politically and culturally based and not inherently natural. She also argued that the sexual revolution required a breakdown of heteronormative models of the traditional family. Her book was more queer-friendly than Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which called lesbians a lavender menace. Millett spearheaded the movement by queer feminists to reclaim that moniker and eventually came out as lesbian herself. She was born in Minnesota in 1934. Her alcoholic father abandoned the family when she was 14, leaving her mother and two sisters in poverty. A wealthy aunt paid for her education, leading her to study comparative literature at Columbia University and at Oxford's St. Hilda's College, and to teach at Barnard College, Bryn Mawr College, and the University of California, Berkeley. Many consider Millett's works to have been milestones in the fight for gender equality in the workplace, legal abortion, and sexual freedom. but she refused to be called a spokesperson for the feminist movement. She's nevertheless featured in the 2014 film She's Beautiful When She's Angry as a feminist leader. Millett followed up sexual politics with autobiographical memoirs on sexuality, literary celebrity, love and relationships, and mental health, including Mother Millett, Sita, Flying, and The Looney Bin Trip. The name of the charitable nonprofit that produces This Way Out, Overnight Productions, was inspired in part by this clever quip by Millett at the 1979 National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights.
We are the only minority group that you can join overnight. In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 9th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Straight military personnel will have to shower with homosexual.
What do you think goes wrong when people shower with homosexuals? Do you think it's the spray makes it catching? I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out.
It's ready, set, stamp for Australian voters now that the final obstacle against the government's marriage equality plebiscite has fallen. With the High Court go-ahead, Mr. Ms. or Mixed Postperson will start delivering ballots on September 15th. This Way Out Sydney correspondent Barry McKay picks up the continuing story.
Last Thursday, Australian High Court judges unanimously found that the Australian Finance Minister Matthias Cormann lawfully allocated $122 million Australian dollars from Treasury to allow the Australian Bureau of Statistics to conduct a same-sex marriage postal survey without Parliament voting on the matter under the guise of an urgent and unforeseen circumstance. Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney, Anne Twomey, spoke on ABC Radio last Friday, expressing her concern that the High Court decision has now given the government leeway to spend money on matters that were affected by its own political imperatives and interests.
Ask yourself, well, what was the urgency in relation to holding a postal survey at this particular date in relation to changing the meaning of a term marriage? I mean, you're talking about changing the meaning of a term that had been in existence for hundreds of years, legislation that's been around for quite some time. There was no external factor saying that you have to make the decision now as opposed to, you know, in 2 months' time or next year or when the next budget cycle came through.
Outside the High Court in Melbourne, after the announcement, long-term Yes campaigner Shelley Argent, who is the national spokesperson of PFLAG Australia, had a hint of disappointment in her voice after the decision was made public. But she said that the Yes campaign had a lot of work ahead of it.
We had to try to make this work because we know that with the postal survey that it will get very nasty and probably on both sides, and we don't need that. But I also want all the LGBTIQ people in the community to know that we are supporting you, that we have done our best, and that's all that we can do.
The postal survey forms will be sent out from the 15th of September and they will need to be returned by post by the 7th of November, with a result expected to be announced by the Australian Bureau of Statistics on the 15th of November.
All people in Australia should be able to marry the person they love.
Anna Brown from the Human Rights Law Centre was one of the lawyers who helped fight the case in the High Court against the government.
This plebiscite was completely and is completely unnecessary. LGBTI people didn't ask for this plebiscite. But now the court has determined that the plebiscite will be going ahead It is absolutely vital that Australians support gay and lesbian people, their friends and their families, and vote yes in the upcoming survey.
Now that the government has won its case to hold the postal survey, the High Court challengers have been ordered to pay the government's legal costs. Donations to help with this are being requested by the Australian LGBTIQ community. Prime Minister Turnbull, a multi-millionaire himself, has had his political skin saved by the decision. A Sydney Morning Herald editorial last Friday said it was unfortunate that the postal survey has had to be conducted solely in order to convince the governing party's recalcitrants to back a measure which Australians, according to opinion polls, already overwhelmingly endorse. This is how ABC Radio reported the reaction to the High Court decision in Parliament last Thursday.
MPs didn't really have their hearts in the beginning of question time, scrolling through their phones and iPads, before the opposition leader Bill Shorten killed two birds with one stone, telling the lower house about the ruling.
I note the High Court's decision moments ago in relation to the Prime Minister's $122 million postal survey on marriage equality. Will the Prime Minister now accept my invitation to write a joint letter to every Australian to support voting yes in the survey?
Yes. I'm interested in the assumption that the Leader of the Opposition makes that joining his signature to mine would actually increase the case for the yes vote. Mr Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition can make his case and I'll make mine. As I've said in this House and in many other places, Lucy and I will be voting yes, and I'll be encouraging others to vote yes.
Prime Minister Turnbull has said that if a no result is returned, then his party will not support a private member's bill in Parliament on the issue. The issue would then be delayed until the next election in 2019. If the result is yes, then the Special Minister of State and Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, said that such a bill could be debated and voted on in Parliament by the end of this year.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. The High Court today has confirmed that before the Parliament next considers this, that the Australian people will have the opportunity to have their say on whether they believe that the law should be changed to allow same-sex couples to marry, and that is a process that will now get underway.
In terms of advertising for the Yes or No campaigns, protection against malicious publications and bribery laws are anticipated to be legislated, and it's expected they will come into effect with the postal survey. Already, Switchboard Victoria, which covers the nation's second most populous state, an LGBTIQ telephone counselling service, have reported a 30% increase of callers to their service, and they have had to put on 16 extra staff.
The vibe of the callers is that people are distressed and they're distraught.
General Manager Joe Ball spoke to ABC Radio last Friday.
You know, we provide our phone service in Victoria and we have people calling from throughout Victoria. And so some people, you know, they're not in the inner city bubble and they may not be surrounded by people who are going to vote yes. And so we're getting people who are quite concerned and worried about what the next, what is going to be 2 months is going to look like.
One Australian citizen has offered his postal survey ballot form on eBay with a starting price of $1,500 Australian dollars. Independent South Australian Senator Nick Xenophon expressed concern on ABC Radio last Friday over the matter.
Any attempt to game the survey, any attempt to distort the results of this important survey, must be met with appropriate legal safeguards. Otherwise, it makes a complete mockery of it.
The eBay seller says that they are selling their ballot paper as they do not care about the result, but knows he might be able to make some money out of others more interested in the outcome. Yes campaign spokesperson Tiernan Brady also spoke on ABC Radio about this the same day.
Whoever it is, what do you think you're doing? This is a serious discussion about real people's lives. You know, I think part of the journey over the next 2 weeks, you know, we're going to see that. The vast majority of conversations will be respectful. You know, the vast, vast majority of Australians want it to be that way. You know, and then on the edges of every campaign, on the no side and on the yes side, you know, you're going to see, you know, a couple of crazy voices. But they're not representative of Australia. And you know, we just always have to remember that as we take this journey together.
Spokesperson for the No campaign and head of the Australian Christian Lobby, Lyle Shelton, on ABC Radio the same day.
Look, I think there's always going to be people out there who do silly things. This really does trivialise what is a very important decision for the Australian nation.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is running the postal survey, has said that the submission of a form that could be proven to have been bought or sold would likely be considered an offence that would attract a fine of more than $2,000 or a 12-month jail term. eBay and Facebook have responded to an Australian Bureau of Statistics call to block listings of ballot papers for sale online. Opinions in the LGBTI community itself on the issue differ. It's not a given that all community members support same-sex marriage. Last week, ABC TV's 7:30 Current Affairs program interviewed a gay couple that did not want to get married and said they would vote no. One of the pair, Mark Poidevin, a committed Catholic, had this to say.
Campaign's gotten nasty on both sides, and I think the comments that I hear is, you're a homophobe if you don't support gay marriage. Well, I'm a gay person here that's coming out and saying, well, no, it's not. It's your right to have a view. Your right to have a view either way, and I think people should be respected for each way. You're not intolerant if you don't support a view.
After a week of campaigning before the High Court decision, already reports have emerged in the Sydney Morning Herald last Saturday that a rising number of people polled by the Fairfax Media Organisation, who runs the respected newspaper, have said that they support the no vote. There is also a rising number of people that are now unsure of how they will vote, and also less people are saying they will be likely to vote at all. The Sydney Morning Herald article said that campaigners point to the 1999 Republic campaign in Australia, which was a failure, the Brexit vote, and the election of US President Donald Trump as evidence nothing can be taken for granted. Tiernan Brady is, however, more hopeful and had this to say at a recent supporters' meeting.
Australia has decided years ago that it is in favour of marriage equality. It's only the world of politics that has failed to catch up. So if we have to go through this process, then we were going to do everything we can to make sure the result in the process reflects the will of the Australian people. And the early signs when we look at enrolment are really strong and really good. So we've just got an awful lot of work to do, a million conversations.
I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out.
Dear Malcolm, I bet you're pretty content. I bet you're kicking back with a glass of rosé. I know you had a small dilemma hanging over your head, and you must be glad now it's out of the way. Oh, I know it must be hard to lead the government of Australia when some aren't comfortable with loving couples who have matching genitalia. And I know you're trying to do what's best to advance your own self-interest. Stay in power for at least another day. Well, Malcolm, please forgive me if I sound a bit irate, but messing with the tenets of our democratic state is a high price to pay. I put down that rosé. Listen up, 'cause I think you can find another way. Need a plebiscite to bestow a human right. Max, I know there's pressure on your right, but even so, this isn't right. Why hold a plebiscite? An expensive and offensive way to change a law which you could change with a simple vote and nothing more.
Don't hold a plebiscite.
Have a simple vote and nothing more. Would your position change if you exchange places with someone LGBTQIA? In schoolyards and churches, our youth are besmirched by a system that hurts through casual slurs, thoughtless words till they learn to internalise shame where the blame to leave their lovers a sin. Sign of the devil within. Well, I can't begin to imagine the further hurt this will
social cause to be having this discourse, not behind closed doors. These are our lives you're dragging through the media. Our families, our partners, our pride. Is it easier to haul us through hate just to hang on to power than fulfill your mandate, you intimidated coward? Did we hold a plebiscite to give women the voting right, or in policies of racism and hate? No, we didn't wait. Why debate through a plebiscite if the hurt and disadvantage might be human after all? It is insulting and appalling. And how come we all know you're stalling, just doing what's right? Well, if you're gonna hold a plebiscite, then I'm gonna rally, march and fight till I know I can hold my partner's hand without a sense of fear. And one day we will stand as man and man when the dust from your government swept up, and the whole world will only wonder what it is we had to fight to stand right here. So I'll vote yes in your plebiscite, though it's one more blow unto our plight. We've suffered so much more, and this isn't the end. If you think we're weak, then think again. Bring on your plebiscite, we're no stranger to a hefty fight. We're stronger than your party might expect, and we won't back down and won't defect. From your plebiscite, though the concept of it isn't right, we won't be fazed by hate and heartlessness. Even though it's wrong, we will vote yes. In your plebiscite, now come you psychophantic parasite, we're stronger than your party might expect. Even though it's wrong, we will vote yes. Vote yes. Even though it's wrong, we will vote yes. Vote yes. Even though it's wrong, we will vote yes.
That was Josh Belperio with a song he wrote for Australia's Marriage Equality Campaign. Dear Malcolm Turnbull is available for download at Josh's website, with all proceeds going to Q Life, Australia's first national peer-to-peer counselling hotline for LGBTQI plus people. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Michael LeBeau and Tanya Kame Perry, produced by Steve Pride and Barry McKay. The Marvelettes and Josh Belperio performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGHE Elma, Washington, Switch 1197 AM Brisbane, Queensland, KUR Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There is a logic at work in many places, including the U.S., a logic of militarization that seeps into, that infects so many aspects of our everyday lives that it often goes unnoticed. It's often taken as a kind of common sense. David Theo Goldberg is interested in this process of militarization, what it is, how it operates, and who or what gets victimized or marginalized in the process. Goldberg, a professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine, and the author of many books, is also interested in the role race plays in militarizing societies, how race is perceived and deployed by regimes to advance certain interests over others, to target certain populations and safeguard others. In an article called Militarizing Race, David Theo Goldberg also asserts that race is the secularization of the religious, that today's anti-Muslim fervor is not primarily religion-focused, and that many groups working to demilitarize society may be reproducing notions and methods of the very militarizing tendencies they oppose. David Theo Goldberg directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute, and he's the author and editor of many books, including Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. When David joined me in studio to discuss his article about militarization, race, and religion, which appeared in the journal Social Text, I asked him whether by militarization he meant only or primarily the inclination to go to war. And I should say that he mentions the names of the French theorist Michel Foucault and of the Prussian thinker Karl von Clausewitz.
So that's a fairly complicated question, of course. By militarizing, I want to begin by the way in which a society cedes to itself a set of conditions in which it fashions both a way of thinking, a development of technology, and the implication of that into the very fabric of the society itself, so that both the way of thinking, the way of organizing itself, the way of policing itself, both internally and externally, the forms of schooling, the forms of socialization, the forms of sociality are all informed by, though not in any reductive sense necessarily simply determined by, what I'm calling this logic of militarization. That disposes a society to go to war without requiring it or demanding it or necessitating that it should go to war in any particular circumstance. Its disposition, when challenged both within and challenged from externally, especially externally, but increasingly internally too, its disposition is to act in ways violently, where war, as we commonly understand it, that is the declaration of an enemy, the definition of responding to that enemy in terms of weaponry, killing, taking prisoners of war, perhaps. So it creates a sensibility where its state and status in the world is defined in terms of its disposition to aggressiveness. And that aggressiveness might spill over into actual war or not. Now, in a broader sense of the notion of war, you can say that it's always at war, a militarized society. And by that, what one means, sort of following somebody like Foucault and maybe even Clausewitz, although in different modalities, there's a sense in which all the local struggles within the society, the struggle over ownership, the struggle over who gets to control land and resources, the struggle over who gets to pocket the wealth, the struggle over who gets put to work, the struggle over how people are treated. I mean, all those, what one otherwise would think as, you know, the social conditions of everyday life in societies that are defined both hierarchically and in terms of owners and those who don't own, in those who are wealthier and those who are not, the disposition to keep one's wealth at the expense of others, and so on. All those struggles, you could say, are a form of war. It's a form of undertaking to push and shove and force and make people act in a way they might on their own not otherwise choose to act. And in that broader sense of war making, you can say that all social struggles, all social conflicts in that kind of way are defined in terms of this this condition of extended war making, where, you know, where Clausewitz says that war is politics by other means. Foucault sort of turns it on its head and said, politics is war by other means, right? So the normal condition under the Foucauldian conception is war, and politics is just an extension of war. So it's in a way turning Clausewitz on his head.
What are some, let's talk about some manifestations of this militarizing logic in everyday life, in social life. So what are, for example, some cultural products in which we can see the logic of militarization at work?
There are a range of things. I mean, we can start with the contemporary and maybe work ourselves back. But think of the way in which battle fatigues have become, in a sense, high fashion, let alone everyday fashion. People wear caps, they wear T-shirts, they wear trousers that are sometimes high-end. You see models walking the catwalk in what effectively are designer fashion battle fatigues, right? But that, in a way, you can say, well, that's trivial. You know, what's the matter with that? But it disposes those in the society to think that not only is that fashionable, but one is at ease with what that conveys. There's an openness, there's an at-easeness, there's a comfort level with seeing oneself in a society where what I'm characterizing as militarization is just part of the everyday fabric of the culture, a kind of common sense that becomes uncontested, which is, you know, different than saying that one honours one's soldiers when they go to war in one's behalf in order to protect one's freedom and so on. This is a way in which the very culture itself, the thinking and the acting, the aggressiveness that one's seeing increasingly on planes, for example, are fueled by this at-easeness, this comfortability with the dispositions of aggression as the common condition of everyday life, right? Instead of working things out by arguing a bit and then coming to the table and mediating the differences that one has, one moves very quickly to an aggressive response, pushing and shoving and kicking and hitting and pulling out a gun and walking around with open carry guns and so on and so on and so on, right? So that you can begin to see the relation between an expression on the one hand, a cultural expression on the one hand, and action that has real material effects in terms of how people interact with each other, respond to each other, the lack of patience, the aggressiveness that's in place and the like. And you can think of other examples of this kind. I mean, there's a sense in which much, I won't say all, but not far from all the high-end technology that we have come to use, certainly since the Second World War and probably a lot earlier, that high-end technology is created through R&D that at least is funded by, if not straightforwardly under the control of the military, right? So you think of motorbikes, motor cars to some degree, Second World War, especially the technologization of motor cars, that the next generation of motor cars after the Model T and things like that. You know, obviously guns, aircraft, GPS today, computers. You can go on and on and on in this kind of way. Boots, backpacks, and so on and so forth. So the way in which you know, we bring into our, not just our daily lives, but our work lives, our communicative lives, and so on, the technologies that we do owe to military R&D sort of shows the way in which this this way of being in the world seeps into our very being without even thinking or about it or realizing it. And that then has further implications. We want more of it. We want the next generation of high-end technology. And so we're going to fuel the resources to operate in that way. But that's, you know, you're not just fueling the R&D, you're also fueling the industry that translates into maintaining not just the technological development, but the way of thinking and way of being in the world that necessarily goes along with it.
David Theo Goldberg is his name. He's professor of comparative literature and anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and he directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You also refer in this article that we're kind of addressing this hour in the journal Social Text. You refer to national anthems and parades and Memorial Day holidays.
Yes, indeed. So when one thinks about national anthems and you go and look at the lyrics, right, rockets are blaring or whatever the exact words are off the top of my head. You know, the home of the land of the free and the home of the brave is a reference to the set of dispositions that I'm pointing to. But it's obviously not just the United States. You look at the anthem in France, you look which refers to explicitly to blood, God Save the Queen, the anthem of the apartheid government under South Africa, which has been maintained in the post-apartheid moment, has fairly aggressive language attendant to it. So you can pretty much go down the, you know, the list of nation states, and you will find, if not all, to a larger rather than lesser degree, the way in which the sort of language of both self-protection and aggression gets sewn together in the maintenance of the boundedness of the nation state, almost necessarily. You think of parades, the opening of parliament, Buckingham Palace, the ways in which you have flyovers over major sports events, the fact that one is singing the national anthem, you know, at pretty much every sports event, you know, and in schools in the morning, right? Just reiterates and repeats so that it becomes, again, second nature. And one almost doesn't think about the aggressivity in the language itself, right? So you can see the way in which the nation state is structured around the set of, the modern nation state is structured around the set of conceptions, dispositions, the shaping of the way people think about these things, uniforms. Uniforms get taken over and form the police. So the police have uniforms. You know, many, many professional jobs have uniforms. Schools, I mean, a little less so in the United States, unless it's a private school that requires a uniform. But I grew up in South Africa where, you know, to go to school, you had to get dressed in a uniform with a jacket and a tie and a white shirt and flannel gray trousers and, you know, black shoes and so on and so forth, right? But that notion of uniform, of creating a commonality that is also then not just common to people, but putting people in line, of lining up. I mean, even the, you know, the production line becomes an extension of a kind of military form of production, right? That people are standing in line. They're obeying the order to do a particular job repetitively over and over and over again.
Yeah, work life, you refer in this article to the clocked workday, to training, to hierarchies in employment and elsewhere. Your piece in the journal Social Text, it appeared in the December 2016 issue, it is entitled Militarizing Race. So you bring race in, and you are a race theorist, among other things. So maybe one way we could get into this relationship that you see between militarization and race is to examine the term, the notion, martial race, M-A-R-T-I-A-L, race. And you know, this notion of martial races informs how you view race in relationship to processes of militarization. So first of all, what is a martial race?
Yeah, so a martial race emerges as a notion, as a concept, under late-ish British colonialism. It's really formulated in the context of the British colonization of India in the 1920s and 1930s by the person commanding the British forces, commander of the forces, General McMahon, Commander McMahon, who writes a book called Martial Races in 1933, yes? And in doing so, he's thinking of the way in which, in his terms, martiality is natural to certain kinds, races of people. I mean, he's explicit about the use of the word race. And there might be other races for whom it's not a natural condition, but, you know, some of the qualities are there that would dispose them to being trained, to becoming martial or martial-like. And then there are those who don't have it at all. So what does he have in mind? So he says quite explicitly that the people of Western Europe, and he names, I mean, he doesn't call it Western Europe at the time, that notion sort of emerges a bit later, but he names the states that are the states of Western Europe, like France and Germany and the Netherlands and of course, Britain, because he represents them and so on, that as a matter of course, they are born with the qualities that make them martial. The qualities of courage, the qualities of physical ability. Now, in the context of India, there's been a long-standing kind of characterization of Hindus, for example, not as martial races, but more like effeminate, right? So the larger proportions of the population of India, in his view, would be effeminate, that is exactly the antithesis of a martial race. But there are, he said, certain folks, certain classes of people, certain races or sub-races of people, if one wants to put it in those terms, such as Sikhs and Gurkhas, who have the capacity or the disposition to be trained by the British into not only being able to fight on behalf of the British in the fights that they're conducting or thinking that they might have to conduct, both in the region and beyond, so creating battalions out of Sikhs and Gurkhas, but also who have the disposition to develop the kind of judgment that would be effective in those kinds of circumstances. And so this notion of martial races develops, in a sense, out of this conception. And I wanted to extend it to indicate that there's a way in which the racial characterization, the racial formation, the racial production of martiality brings together this notion of raciality and martiality into a kind of self-defining that then disposes this aggressivity to the world, but also a self-ascribed capacity to rule the world at the same time. I mean, I'm reading this into the way in which a society or a range of societies conceive of itself coming out of, you know, the post 18th century, really, sort of self-conception of modernity, in which race defines the modern state formation. Those who see themselves as having the capacity to develop, shape, lead both the nation state and the commonwealth of nation states over others who are taken not to have that capacity at all.
In other words, people of color are seen as subordinate as opposed to people who are white are seen as the people who ought to rule.
Right. Those who are European or of European descent, right, ascribe to themselves the capacity to rule over those who are not, right, where those who are not are, you know, the wide range of people of color.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David Theo Goldberg is my guest. He's a professor of comparative literature and anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author and editor of many books on racism and race, including most recently, Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. And he wrote an article entitled Militarizing Race for the journal Social Text. So how much does race play a role in a militarizing society's determination of who belongs and who doesn't? And I'm thinking, for example, of, you know, the assaults on and all the rhetoric against Muslims in this country, which suggests a religious category. And you actually do bring up religion as well as race in this piece, in Social Text. So if we stick with race for just a moment, how important is race and racial categories to a militarizing society like the U.S. Determining who's the enemy, whether it be within or without, and who is really part of the main fabric of society who needs to be defended?
In my understanding of the history of race and state making, the way I put it pithily, there's a much longer argument here, but the way I put it pithily is that modern states become modern by taking up, in not always in the same way, obviously, but in overlapping and common ways, taking up the organizing principles of race. And the organizing principles of race to define who's in charge, who's in control, who's elevated, and who's not in the society, who has access, who has privilege, who's excluded, who has ownership, who has control, who rules, and who's ruled over. You know, the argument is that you can look at any society in its being brought into the fold of modernity, and the language of race creeps in at one point or another. It's obvious for societies that were colonized, there the technology of race itself is explicit invariably. But it's there to increasingly explicitly from the 18th century onwards internally in European societies. So, you know, up until about the middle of the 18th century, for European societies, while race was implicitly there internally, explicitly It was there always in relation to the elsewhere, the colonies, the outside. You know, the wars that were taking place within Europe at the time were religious wars until the mid-18th century. And it's really from the middle of the 18th century, I mean, the emergence of the Enlightenment, after all, right, that the language of race becomes more explicated within the boundaries of Europe itself for a number of different reasons. So there's a sense in which the technologies of race get taken up by modern societies to define who belongs and who does not, who has full belonging and who is at best partial belonging. You know, at a moment that modern societies, I mean, as they become modern, are becoming increasingly heterogeneous, right? The fact that there were colonies means that the traffic was not only one way from the colonizer to the colonized. I mean, people returned. They brought back ideas. They brought back slaves. People traveled. You know, in London by 1800, 1 to 2% of the population of London was of African descent, right? That's 10 to 20,000 people in a city of 1 million people. So there was a visible presence in that sense. And race then, I mean, immediately that heterogeneity shows up in the society, race becomes explicated, right? It becomes absolutely explicit. And so race is taken up precisely in order to define who belongs or belongs fully and who does not. And it becomes the means by which both identification takes place, you know, to which race, to which population group do you belong? So it becomes at exactly the time also that census taking, that is racially explicit, kicks into place. I mean, in the United States, the first census of 1790, that is national, right, is defined in terms of a number of categories, including racial categories, right? Men, women, white, Negro, to use that term, they used, and American Indian, right, Native American. So, you know, three of the five categories that were counted were in this extended sense racial categories. Precisely in order, I mean, census taking gave you a picture of the population. So it was all in order to count who's there and who's not. But that count was also to be able to establish lines of control in relation to who properly belonged and who didn't, who could access certain kinds of work and who would be delimited to menial labor, who would be the wealth producers and who would be the wealth takers, and so on and so forth. And so race becomes a crucial form that then factors into the way in which militarization factors itself out, because in order to maintain those lines of racial division and control, it required a form of aggressivity. You step out of line, we're going to whack you over the head. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to shoot you, we're going to subject you to penal conditions and so on and so forth. So the society takes up race in order to define the lines of division within the society, and then also to be reinforced by the forms of militarization that maintain those divisions and that hierarchy.
Let's talk about religion and the theological, which I said you bring up also in this article in Social Text. You write that militarization and the theological are sewn together. How?
Yes. So, I mean, we've seen the ways in which militarization, already we've spoken about the ways in which military forms of culture then get taken up in the broader society that conceives of itself as not necessarily, in a professional sense, the military, but infuse the daily lives through parades or through, you know, other forms of social definition and so forth, practice and the like. Teamwork, the way in which, you know, even in Wall Street today, the sense in which the control room in financial operations where trades are being made is called the war room or the operation room or the turret, right? So you can see the way in which, I mean, the high end of corporate life in society is driven by the very language, strategy and tactics, the kind of winning and losing, the ways in which the very conception that emerges out of the military then infuses broad understandings of the society and operation. So the theological provides one with a way, if one thinks back into sort of what a religious conception and self-conception offer. It offers a narrative of origins, of where we come from and how we come to be who we are. It offers a sense of kinship, of who belong to each other and how that belonging came about. It offers a sense of community in that sense, the belonging, the encouragement to treat others who are like one in certain sorts of ways, and those who are not like one to dismiss or treat in ways that are less convivial or less generous. And so you can see in a variety of these registers how militarization and the theological come together. For one, historically, there's a sense in which armies were either in service of or responding to religious conception. Crusades in behalf of the driving religion, whether it was straightforwardly the church or not, the way in which then, as the military historically emerges out of that understanding, the way in which in the military itself, it takes on and keeps certain vestiges of that kind of religious self-understanding. And I don't just mean saying prayers in the morning. I have a quite marvelous little story from having served very briefly in the army in South Africa when I was an 18-year-old, which I'll come back to in a moment. But the way in which medals, right, reflect religious emblems, the Iron Cross being the most obvious, right, or the way in which greetings get socialized into the daily life of military practice and so on and so forth. The story I was going to refer to was, so while in the army, there was a drought in the part of South Africa. There'd been no rain for like 3 months or 6 months. And so the commanders of the military called one morning that the whole camp come onto the parade ground in order to pray for rain. Being a skeptic about such things, I sort of wondered how this was going to play out. But as we all fell out onto the parade ground, these dark clouds started sort of gathering overhead, and I thought, oh, maybe the Afrikaners really do have a direct line to God over here, right? The prayers were said, and, an hour later, everybody was dismissed, and as everybody dismissed, even though they'd been rumbling in the clouds started breaking up, and there wasn't rain for another 6 months, right? But you can see the way in which, in that particular context, the theological, God will guide us, not just in bringing rain, but in bringing victory to ourselves. So those dispositions sort of then come together. But there's also, as I argue in the piece, the way in which historically the theological gives way to the racial, and the racial takes up the very logic of the theological in providing the origin story, in providing kinship relations, a sense of community, so that I characterize this as the racial being a secularization of the religious, the way in which, what we identify as religious self-understanding and so on sort of falls explicitly by the wayside, but both the dispositions and the forms of action get taken up in the name of the racial as a kind of secularized version of what had been provided by the theological.
Can you be a little more specific about that? Because this is very interesting, this notion that race is the secularization of the religious.
So, yeah, the the way in which this plays out is during the period of the medieval, the religious, the church, the both the institution of the religious and the sense of socialization and way of being in the world was theologically driven. I don't mean to say that this suddenly came to an end, of course, in the, you know, say 1500. But as one begins to get the emergence of explicit forms of race thinking, first as kinship or emerging out of kinship, then lineage, then type, and into species and subspecies over a 200 to 300 year period, you had the racial looming larger and larger. I mean, in that shift, first from being the externality of Europe, the outside of Europe, and then, you know, from the middle of the 18th century onwards, increasingly brought into the self-definition of Europe internally as well. And so you see the shift taking place as religious self-conception, you know, in the Reformation, even arguably under the Counter-Reformation, but emerging out of that fight between what today one would characterize as the Roman Catholic on the one hand and the emergence of the Protestant on the other, is the shift to the religious becoming an individualized, private self-definition, right? So that the religious becomes a form of self-choice, where hitherto it had not been that at all. And what emerges at the level of the social in order to fill that kind of vacuum that's left at the register of the definition of the communal, of the broadly social, is the racial rushing in to provide definition of that. And the racial doesn't assume the explicit language of the religious, but it takes on the very work that the religious had been doing, and it puts it into its own terms. So what do I mean by that? If you take the notion of origins, where do we come from? Well, we all come from under the religious, the self-understanding, we're born one under God, and then a certain moment, a subgroup emerges to define itself in a given part of the world with a set of characteristics and a way of thinking, a relation to pre-life and afterlife, and so on and so forth. Well, the racial begins to take that over and provide a different language of articulation for that. But it's still providing a story of origins. It's still providing a story about kinship. It's still providing a narrative of community and who belongs to the community and who doesn't, in the way in which the religious had previously done.
His name is David Theo Goldberg. He's professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine, and he directs the University of California Humanities Research Institute. And he's, again, the author and editor of many books on racism and race theory. And he wrote an article for the journal Social Text, its December 2016 issue that we're discussing today. It's called Militarizing Race. So, David, what about the anti-Muslim fervor today and in recent years? Is that, in your view, primarily religion-focused?
I want to say that it's not just religiously focused. If it were just religiously focused, there'd be, you know, theological debates, there'd be, you know, an understanding of different ways of seeing the world and so on and so forth, right? I mean, all of that, of course, is there. But it's, you know, Muslims are largely defined in terms of how the aggressor thinks they ought to look, and then defined in terms of their place relation in the world, right? Their geographic location, where they emanate from, right? What their lineage is, what their kinship structure is. And so that becomes immediately racially conceived, right? And so, you know, the stories that we're getting on almost a daily basis of people boarding a plane and then shouting at people with brown skin, "You don't belong here, go back to where you come from." You know, there might be a presumption of where you come from. You know, there's that funny story of a woman of color in London being shouted at one point, you know, maybe half a decade or so ago, with some horrible white person in the street says, "Go back to where you come from." And she says, Well, if you would give me cab money, I'd happily get in a cab and go to the next suburb over where I really come from. Right? But you can see the way in which there's a kind of self-understanding and a set of presumptions, a presumptuousness that's tied to color, that's tied to dress, that's tied to perceived culture or cultural difference, that's tied to color and its relation to culture. You know, you might say body and its relation to behavior. And those stereotypically defined sort of conceptions and self-conceptions are then drawn on so that it's not just a religious understanding. It's religion and race kind of mutually seeping into each other and becoming more or less indistinguishable. And, you know, one sees it played out in different ways in different parts of the world. So just to give an example of how this becomes so presumptuous, when people who are prone to discriminate in exactly these sorts of ways are asked who, you know, who they think of when they immediately think of Muslims, it's like most likely to be people from the Middle East, right? It's not likely, you know, maybe it's from Pakistan. Right. Maybe it's from Afghanistan. Maybe it's, you know, but more likely to be Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and North Africa and so on and so forth. Right. It's almost never from Indonesia. And it's certainly not from, you know, the neighbor next door. Right. And unless it's characterized in a particular kind of way where those lines are already drawn. Yeah. And so the sort of understanding where the lines are already taken to be drawn so that, you know, those who are presumed to be here and those presumed not to come from here are already written into the social script that then just gets reified in terms of the hard lines that are being defined to define people in and out. These things are today a deeply inscribed way in which religion is being knotted together with race.
If we get back to the militarization of society and we look at perhaps, you know, one of the most vivid manifestations of that, which is societies going to war in the way that they do, what kinds of wars in terms of, you know, resource consumption, energy consumption, how big can the wars be these days in order to serve the interests of elite, to serve the interests of capital, to serve the interests of the neoliberal regime?
There are a number of things to be said here as well. I mean, the first is that there's been a longish history, certainly a 20th century history, maybe starting with the First World War, but maybe you could trace it back to the Civil War, interestingly enough. And you can ask whether today we're back in incipiently drawing the lines of a civil war, which doesn't necessarily first and foremost resort to arms, right? Civil wars are not simply about arms. They're about different ways of seeing and being in the world. And those divisions are very starkly drawn in the society we're currently inhabiting, right? And so, you know, maybe we're in America's third civil war, that civil war, as it's called in the 19th century, was the first, and the second was the civil rights struggle. Maybe we're exactly in that moment. So that's a way of saying that, you know, wars can be small and social, but have great effect. So you think of the way in which warring and its dispositions orders our social self-conception. So, you know, just about every social struggle then became a war on crime, a war on poverty, a war on drugs, a war on prostitutes, a war on bad dudes, a war on immigrants, a war on Muslims, a war on you name it, right? So everything that became a tension around differences, difference in ways of thinking, differences in ways of behaving and acting, differences in ways of thinking about who we are and who we should be, those struggles become infused with the language of war, if not seen as actual wars themselves, right? And once you think in those terms, then, you know, the wars that are engaged in order to extend not just the forms of sociality, but also the self-understood well-being of the society, its mode of production, its capacity to flourish, its capacity to draw on the resources of others, the capacity to control labor flows, the capacity to control financial flows, the capacity to control what happens when capital lands on the ground in a particular place, to protect investments, to protect national interests. And all of those things become bid up as larger and larger forms of, you know, peacemaking is then an extension of war keeping, if you want to mix your metaphor, Sophia, right? So the two are deeply, deeply sewn together in this conception of social militarization. So that there's a necessity that the wars not be too large, because as soon as they're too large, they undercut, right, the very well-being of the society in play. They're draining on human capital, they're draining on financial capital, they're draining on, you know, the natural capital of the society, right, its resources and so on and so forth. And so if one needs for a kind of military industrial slash academic complex, but certainly a military industrial complex, the wars have to be ongoing but low level, so that, you know, the population almost doesn't pay attention to them, right? They're just kind of humming in the background. And in a sense, that's, you know, that's been happening for at least the last 50 years. There's been, you know, war of one kind or another, not just at the what I characterized a moment ago as kind of social struggles, but actual war making. Troops being involved in battles of small or larger, skirmishes of small or larger kinds in, you know, various parts of the world and within the homeland as well. And so for a society that's driven by militarization, it's imperative both to maintain the levels of investment, both political, social, and economic, to maintain the conditions of possibility of successive states of that war-making and that economic form of being. But it's also required not to get too big to get out of hand, so it becomes exactly draining.
David Theo Goldberg joins me in studio. He's a prominent race theorist, the author of many books, and a professor at the University of California, Irvine. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So we have, on the one hand, one could say the forces toward militarization of the society, toward further militarization of the society, and then we have those forces, those parts of society that want to demilitarize society, and, you know, we would include social movements or some of them in that category. And you make an interesting argument in this piece about whether, in fact, these social movements, these opponents of militarization, incorporate certain militarizing characteristics and notions and ideas within them. So I wondered if you could talk about that and also talk about what the implications for that is.
Yes. So the, you know, what I've been arguing is that, in part, there's a way of thinking that I'm ascribing to this notion of social militarization, wherever it might occur, not just in the society, right? And I've tried to spell out in bits and pieces sort of what aspects of those forms of thinking are. And those forms of thinking include, as I made reference along the way, notions of tactics, notions of strategy, a kind of teleology, a weaponizing in relation to effecting certain ends, the way in which ends are defined and maximized. Those forms of winning the battle or winning the war against others in a corporate kind of engagement and the like. And so when we think about struggles against militarization, or what I characterize at the end of the piece as an undertaking to think what demilitarizing the society might begin to look like, somewhat alongside thinking about colonization and decolonization, right? So, you know, what would it undertake to undo, to stop one's mode of thinking in these terms? So I think one has to give in, you know, as one is engaging in these forms of struggle, in these forms of undertaking to define the society otherwise than in these terms. You know, we all too often think about, you know, using notions of tactics or strategy, of using the kind of operational language, of having a military-like operation that will run like clockwork. I mean, at one end, you have the current president of the United States who said his administration is running like a military machine, right? Well, if that's how a military machine runs, well, already double woe to everybody. But on the other hand, you have struggles against that, sort of saying we have to be as well-organized, as well-oiled a machine as that in order to face up to it. And what I think is a challenge is to ask ourselves, are there other ways of thinking unpredictably about what those struggles would look like? Because that, you know, that way of thinking is utterly predictable. It puts you into a mode of responding of the very kind that one is antithetical to. So you're trying to bring about a transformation or an undoing of the very thing by using its own, you know, the master's tools against itself, so to speak. And what I'm trying to get to is, are there creative, not predictable ways that those modes of thinking restrict us from even seeing, where the forms of response, the forms of undertaking, activity, intervention, are both unpredictable and make in the mode of intervention itself get people to think differently about the very positions they're in, so they start acting differently, they start making different choices. And they make those choices for themselves precisely because they're thinking in different terms than the ordered terms of the day, than the terms of order that one is being given and reproducing in the very undertaking to undo them. So that's the challenge I want to end with. I don't have a straightforward answer, but it's a way of thinking. You know, there's a sort of cliche of thinking out of the box. That would be thinking out of the box.
Right, and it's precisely the predictability of the regime that in some ways makes it vulnerable to subversion or assault. And so, you know, the predictability of movements in response could make, obviously, them very vulnerable in relation to the regime.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you know, there's small and larger ways in which to do this. If you think of interventions, you know, struggles on campus to maintain free speech in the wake of its closing down. And so, I mean, the first mode is to go out and have a rally, right? And it's, you know, the police then gather around, make sure that it's boxed in. You know, it's not unimportant. It's a form of communication and of community making itself. So I don't want to belittle it. I mean, it has an important role. But it also stops one from thinking, so, you know, they know we're going to do this because we do it every time, right? Are there other ways in which to stop them short in their tracks and say, hey, what are they saying to us? You know, we hadn't thought in this way, and all of a sudden they're stopping us in our tracks and saying, well, maybe we should convey the message that we want to convey to those inhabiting, in this case, a university space, to get those who are exactly comfortable, right, in their mode, not to react by saying, oh, there they go again, but to say, hey, they have a point. Let me think along with them and think otherwise than I've been thinking in these ways.
David Theo Goldberg, professor of comparative literature and anthropology at UC Irvine, author and editor of books, many books, most recently, Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And Sites of Race. And we have a link to his faculty page at UC Irvine, as well as to at least one of his books, as well as to his article in the journal Social Text called Militarizing Race. David, great seeing you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
And that interview first aired on March 22nd of this year. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.